Question before we start, where would I look for more information on that WWV receiver that was discussed last week? Does somebody have that real handy?
On the HAMSI website, there's a description of the GRAPE SDR, and that was what you were talking about.
Great, GREAT.
No, like the fruit,
Grape.
GRAPE.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay, so Nathaniel, want to start the recording?
Go ahead.
Well, welcome to the March 9th, 2021 session of Tangerine SDR and HAMSI technical meeting. So this week I've been doing two things. I was working on the Tangerine simulator, and I've gotten a basic start, and I've been going through protocols like crazy. So I have a whole bunch of questions for Bill, but we can leave those for at some point. And but I'm making some progress on getting the pieces together to build the protocol for the programming part of setting up the Tangerine. So it's coming together. Also, I'm involved with Tapper, and Tapper's been trying to update their Whisper transmitters. There's a small glitch that they work with Raspberry Pis 2s and 3s, and they do not work with Raspberry Pi 4s. But we think we have all the necessary changes. So I've been working with Bruce on that. And also George is involved, and Dave is a little bit involved. So it's an interesting little side project. So that's it for me. Next on the list, we have Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's been a busy week for me, getting ready for the HAMSI workshop. And this weekend, I went through and got the schedule updated pretty much as much as possible. I think it's almost complete. A few more details are filling in, but I think we're off to a good workshop. So very exciting. W2NF, back to net.
The flyer you sent out was quite nice. So
Thank you.
good. Next on the list, we have John in 8 OBJ. Go ahead, John.
Kind of a busy week. I got the parts list, I believe I mentioned that last week, for the grape up on the website. I also got the entire listing of parts needed to you need to purchase to put the whole system together up there, including links on Amazon to buy everything. Started in earnest on working on the antenna that I bought two of, Super Speedo Quicko from Nathaniel. A magnetic antenna's direction pointing is orthogonal to common sense direction. It's not what you think. I'll leave it at that. I'm in the process of trying to set that up in the backyard, but yesterday it was only had a high of 31 degrees. So I waited to the day and I have just starting to get started on that. Looks like you have to place it at a minimum of 5 feet above the ground. So I'm going to try that first and see how well that works. I started looking at the A to D for the Grape 2 and discovered the one I picked uses I squared S bus, which would take over the I squared C bus that Scotty is using. And I'm sure he would shoot me if I did that. So I'm now redoing that and looking at another A to D possibility. I sent out a document to John Ackerman and Scotty about the clock requirements I have. The only thing we haven't resolved yet is I have an 8 kilohertz sample or start A to D conversion clock that I have to come up with that has to be super accurate. And I've used up the four outputs for the four synthesizers and the one PPS. And the comm link is indeed a UART as Scotty thought it was. But we have to figure out how to get an accurate 8 kilohertz sample clock because that affects what frequency you actually measure because that's the sample time. So other than that, back to net.
Fine business. John, could you put a link in the list for Joe, who wanted where he could
Sure.
find out more about your grape?
Yeah, I'll send them some wine.
Okay, very good. Next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave, and good evening, everyone. Not a lot to report. I did happen to get my first COVID vaccine shot last week, so I'm on the way to a better life, I guess. So anyway, that's about it from here. Back to you, Dave.
Fine business. I had to take my wife in to get her second one, and
I'm jealous. So
that was Saturday, and I still have 2 weeks before my second one. So,
yeah. Ohio just opened up 60 last week, and then this morning they opened it up down to 50. So it's a total,
yeah.
I'm not going to be getting one for a while.
Yeah. Well, I'm appreciating being still associated with a university that they have facilities here that are doing a nice job.
Yeah, so there's Case, but we're not allowed to get shots there. So.
Oh, okay. Next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill. Sorry about your trees.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Dave. other than walking around my property and looking at all the pine trees that go up about 50 feet and then they go over an angle like this and leaning towards the power line. all I've been doing, I worked a little bit on preparing the talk to give at HamSci. Also, I've got the grape interfaced with the GPS receiver so that when it starts, it can talk to the GPS receiver hat and find out the time and date, and can automatically assign the correct time and date to the digital RF files, and because that's important to know the exact time, and it also saves the latitude and longitude in the digital RF metadata. So we've got that to where that works automatically. And I guess that's probably about it for this week. Back to Ned.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Dave Witten, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. Nothing I care to report. So that's it. Back to you.
Fine business. And then next on the list, we have Chong Gaming. Go ahead.
I think his name's Kong.
Kong Gaming. Okay.
Kong Ying.
Oh.
Sorry. I'm phonetically pronouncing it. Sorry. Kong?
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, it's Kong Ying.
Okay. Go ahead.
So, aside from, you say something?
Go ahead and whatever you have done relative to this or are interested in or whatever you want to ask.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, aside from schoolwork, I was still learning about the FPGA. I started to do a few more little projects. I started learning about a little more about structural coding, I think that's what it's called, and behavior coding. And I tried to connect the FPGA to an Arduino to play around with both of them at the same time, but I haven't succeeded in doing that yet. So I think that's pretty much it.
Okay. Very good. Next on the list, we have David in 1HAC. Go ahead, David.
Good evening, everyone. Really busy right now getting ready for a sounding rocket. Looks like I'll be going down to Wallops next week, put an instrument in, getting ready. This is a VLF propagation experiment being launched from Wallops. So doing some groundwork and putting the payload together. And it's getting interesting. And then, we've been working with Claire Trope, who's going to be giving our talk for HamSci on our AM Doppler project, which is showing some very interesting results. And we're going to be interested to see how that, how people see that connecting with the WWV experiments and whatever else is going on. So back to Net.
Very good. Next on the list, we have Dev, KC3 PVE. Go ahead, Dev.
Hello, good evening, everyone. So we're starting a new week at the University of Wisconsin here. We're preparing from the HAMSAI workshop 2021. Nathan is working towards that in full gear. And I'm also trying to present if I can detect irregularities in the ionograms that I had processed with the data we collected here at the University of Scranton, at Nathaniel's house. So we are looking at TIDs, and we are also looking at irregularities, and we'll later on we aim to see if we can discuss about the sources of these to process if how they are connected, how they could possibly be connected, or they could be not connected. Thank you.
Very good. Next on the list, we have Gary, AF8A. Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, good evening, everyone. Just sitting here copying the mail, trying to stay current. Back to net.
You look like you're in Svalbard.
Reykjavik.
Okay.
Not far.
Very good. Okay, next on the list, we have Human. Go ahead, Human. KD2MCR. Go ahead.
Okay, good evening, everybody. I've been working on data itself. I have downloaded data from the magnetometer that we installed at Jenny Jump, and along with the data from the real science magnetometer co-located there. So I'm in the process of comparing those data sets in preparation for the HAMSAI meeting. And also in the lab, I brought the magnetometer to sort of characterize the noise performance and noise and then the resolution performance in the lab. I just wanted to see how that performs in more detail. So that's what I'm working on right now. I'm working on plotting. So I'd like to, hopefully I can share those plots with you guys sometime soon. Back to Ned.
Very good. Next on the list, we have James, KG4, DSG. Go ahead.
You got me now?
Yep.
Okay. Reading the mail, trying to stay current with the list. I did have a question that can be addressed at the open discussion about digital RF and building from source. And I'll just defer that until the discussion point. I'm looking for some assistance. Back to net.
You should be able to find it in this group. So next on the list, we have Jay, WB8SBI. Go ahead, Jay.
Hang on, I'm there. I'm coming. Hi there.
Hello.
The laptop was a little bit slow tonight. Other than having received Moderna dose number 2 today, nothing else going on around here.
Well, very good.
So, just looking forward to the upcoming HAMSAI 2-day event, which I am registered to, and this, and also the upcoming QSO today, all weekend event. So, Nathaniel, I'm really looking forward to this year's your presentations this year. So, otherwise, that's all from up here in Michigan.
Very good. So next on the list, we have Jim K4BSE. Go ahead, Jim.
Good evening, Ned. Well, I haven't gotten a lot done because I had to get my taxes out. They're in the mail now to the accountant. And so I got a little bit of time coming up. I did spend some time trying to duplicate the experiment of separating WWV from WWVH by using the time ticks. And it turns out not to be as easy as I thought it might have been. I was able finally to capture one very good sample, which I was able to make measurements on the time delay between the two. It was about 18 milliseconds. Which is about right for my QTH. I've got to double check the exact numbers, which I didn't have time to do, but it looks like about right. I was also trying to bring up VoCap to read, to estimate, to look at some propagation issues from those two stations and others down to the South Pole area. I have not had really time to work on that. Downloaded it, but I had a problem installing it. And so I'll get back to that probably now that my taxes are in. Back to Ned.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have, Joe, W7LUX. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. Now I'm unmuted. Okay. Am I unmuted?
Nope. We can hear you.
Okay, fine. Let me think. Just got my second COVID shot here a couple of weeks ago. So courtesy of the VA and more years than I care to admit to. But a couple of weeks ago, Scotty asked me if I could measure phase noise. And so I've been working on building up a backup facility to do exactly that. Looks like I will be able to measure phase noise down to the requirements before very long. Other than that, I'm very much enjoying the meetings here.
Very good. So next, let's see, we had John. So it's Jonathan, KC3EEY is next.
Hi, everybody. I wanted to take a look at the direction of the design of the VLF module. So I reached out to some people in the meeting today. Scotty, Tom, David, and John, because I was unsure of the direction of the design, because I felt the way that it was I guess you could say over-engineered or unnecessary to have this high bandwidth SDR. Used with VLF data. But after talking with Tom, I kind of missed the whole point of the VLF data being made available to the anybody who needs it. So with that, I had some questions about how it's going to be handled, and if anybody thought about what's going to happen to it after it leaves the SDR, whether we're going to use VLFRX tools to deal with it, which I think we should, or if we convert it into another format like a digital RF. But I don't have any experience with that, and I haven't written any programs. So I would much prefer to utilize VLFRX tools as much as possible, because I think that they have a greater benefit to the community. So with that, I was wondering what will be sent to a central control in terms of VLF data. Is it going to be the streams? Is it going to be events only, like whistlers or SIDs? And how is it going to be handled? So that was my question to the Brain Trust, because that's something that I really didn't think about. So if you guys have any tips or information, or any, you know, what you guys think, let me know. Other than that, back to the net.
Well, fine business, Jonathan. Why don't we leave that question for a discussion during the general session? I want to a couple more people and we're finished with the list. So next on the list, we have Michael, AA8K. Go ahead, Michael. Fine business. And next on the list is Scotty, W2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Can you hear me now? Thanks, Dave. Yeah, it's been a really busy week this week. And the good news has been mostly all on HamSci Tangerine stuff. So I did a poster for the upcoming Ham Expo, and there's going to be on display in the I think in the ORI booth or the ground station booth, because there's a whole story on why AMSAT's not going to be there, but it's going to be in the space arena. So it's going to be more of a focus on the space weather rather than the Tangerine hardware itself. So, and I sent that to you, Nathaniel. So I'd like comments to see if you think it's a good one for, I only have, I think there's 10 slides, 10 little thumbnails, and only a couple of them are on the actual hardware. The rest is on what measurements are we going to do with the hardware that we've got. So, and one thing I want to remind those people who are not going to be on daylight savings time next week, that the meeting time will change because we go on daylight savings a week from Saturday. I mean, this Saturday. So we switch. So for Joe and I, at least on here, will definitely be switching to 6 o'clock instead of 7 o'clock local time, because we're the only sane ones that stay normal. And you guys all switch times all over the place and nobody can keep track of where you are. So let's see. Next, we got the image for the data engine. I have an image for the data engine preliminary placement. It's done. The CAD guys got it done. So during the general time, I can show that to you if the people who are interested. And we got the clock. I got the clock module production schematic finished. We haven't reviewed it, but I've got it completed enough that we got a good read into the CAD guy. So now I have the data engine, the RF module, and the clock module all read in. And we'll be able to place things together. We already have shown that the RF modules and the data engine go together. And we did find some interference issues. So Tom, you and I are going to have to talk about that. I think we're going to have to move some of the diodes that are on the back that are the protection diodes for the relays. So this is like nothing to do with RF, but they have to be moved over because there's some through-hole parts that come through, and they probably won't interfere, but I don't like probably. I want to make sure definitely. And since the boards kind of will be able to move a little bit when you're inserting them, I don't want to tear parts off the board when you're sliding parts together. So we may end up doing that, but that's the whole purpose of having CAD models of all three boards so that we can see where the parts are on the boards and are they, and we have all the parts that we built for the boards have a Z dimension. So we know how tall they are. So the boards have, we can actually create an AutoCAD model for each board with an envelope, if you will. So when we plug them together, turn them this way, we can see, well, are the tall parts going to hit the tall parts? Are they going to slide past each other? Is there enough room? And it's pretty useful to avoid problems. So that's a lot of progress on the data engine and the clock module. I also started on some test fixtures for the data engine. Because I suppose that we're going to test, Tom, we're going to test the RF board by plugging one into a data engine, and we're going to test the clock module by plugging one into a data engine, but how are we going to test the data engine? So what I've done is I'm having the CAD guy build some little paddle boards that are clock module and leaf boards and RF modules that just have a connector on them that loop back pins to pins. So you just plug them in, and then you put a special program in the FPGA that runs patterns through the outputs and looks for the inputs to detect shorted and open pins. One of the ways that I did it on the HPSDR project, all those FPGAs that we built on those boards had test code versions that I could load into the FPGA, plug a bunch of loopback plugs on the board, and then run the program. And we got lots of LEDs so they can come up and flash or come on red or green or tell us whether we passed or not. And the FPGA image, I'm working on the pinout of that right now too. I did find some problems with it that I corrected on the data engine. I still want to make sure that we're going to be okay with it. But because what we have to do is we have to assign the pins based upon the schematic of the data engine, but we also have to assign the pins on what's going to be plugged in. Because since the pins are programmable, I want to connect them up so they will actually talk to an RF module. And we reprogrammed some of those pins to do different things on the RF module other than just data, because we have some I2C and I2C port and things like that. So, and it looks like Tom, I think we're going to have to use a CMOS interface to the A to Ds, because the LVDS, Altera only supports LVDS on 2.5 volt buses, and all the IOs are 1.8 volts. So I'm looking at the interface now, trying to figure out how to program the FPGA to talk to the A to Ds, and I don't think I can set them to 2.5 volts. I mean, I could do it, but I don't think it'd be very healthy for the A to D converter. So we need to look at that and see if we can figure out a way to make this work the best way. And that is about it for this week. So back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And the next on the list is Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening. It's been a week full of email to lots and lots of different folks on lots of aspects of the project. So most of those have been resolved. Back to the group.
Well, fine business. And so at this point, if I haven't missed somebody, we're open for general discussion.
If I could jump in here, what Scotty was just talking about, if at all possible, please do it LVDS. CMOS levels create a tremendous amount of RF hash.
Yes. Well, I mean, we could try it. And what I've heard is rumors are, and I don't particularly like this solution, but hey, you have to use what works, right? The rumor has it that you could set the IOs to LVDS and set the IO voltage to 1.8, and it will work anyway. Even though mm-hmm. it's not really in the LVDS spec, it still will fall close enough into the in the spec as far as the current for low and high that you will it'll still work.
Yeah.
I've actually heard of people doing it the other way and setting the voltage to 3.3 and setting it to LVDS, but I've never heard of them going to 1.8. So
yeah, we need to check the specs of the transmitters and receivers there.
Yeah, the ADD converter levels, I think I'll have to check the CMOS. I think the CMOS levels are 1.8 volts also, because I'll have to check the schematic. My recollection is the part only has a 1.8 volt supply line.
That's right.
Right. So,
and it doesn't have an IO supply line?
I don't think so. I'll have to check.
Okay. Yeah, we need to check that.
It does, because it's limited to 2 volts. So
yeah, the LVDS has to operate at double the clock rate. So it operates at 245 megabits per second per lane. So it's running DDR, and there's, I can move the clock edge plus or minus 4 nanoseconds on the clock. So I can center up the front half I and the back half I, but they have to be LVDS to keep those eyes open at 245 megabits.
Right.
Tom, we have 2 buses there. So if you run them at CMOS levels, then you're going to be running them at only 122 megahertz, correct?
They share the exact same pins. So what happens is that the same number of pins are used. They operate at the same 1.8 volt voltage level, but instead of being differential pins, they're now single-ended pins operating at 122.88 CMOS.
Right.
Right. But as David said, you know, the noise level just absolutely goes through the roof when you do that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have anything like random, like the 2208 has, right?
There is a little bit of randomization, but I think it's only for a couple of LSVs. I don't think it's the entire data word. Still, you cannot rely on randomizing the data word to get rid of the noise, because statistically, you'll have pins, enough pins moving at the same time that you'll get significant noise density.
Do we need to just put in level translators?
Well, those would have to go on the data engine itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that would be, first of all, it would be a lot of area. Second of all, the question would be, is that really going to reduce the noise? Because if I ended up having to run CMOS on the FPGA, then I haven't really saved a lot except made the traces shorter.
Yeah, they'd be much shorter at that point.
Yeah. So, but the thing is, we can run the bus at 1.8. We have to run the bus at 1.8 because the voltage maximum on the A to Ds is 1.8. Mm-hmm. However, but that's the thing is, since the A to Ds are, we're hooking to the outputs of the A to D, I would think that I could possibly make the bus run at 2.5 volts because I'm really looking for current. I mean, the voltages are only 0.6 volt difference between high and low on LVDS. So that would be fine, except the problem is we have other IO pins that connect, control pins that connect to that bus that are not going to like 2.5 volts because all of the IO on that part's 1.8. So maybe we put some level translators on those few pins.
Okay. All the pins you're talking about are outputs from the ADD. The ADD is driving them to 1.8 volts in the ground or whatever the LVDS levels are. Those are all outputs.
What about the, there's an I2C bus and there's some other control pins. Those are all outputs. Well, except for the I2C, it's open collector, but so that doesn't matter.
The part has an SPI with a bi-directional and three wire SPI at 1.8 volts IO. And all the I2C are a discrete parts on the board. They don't go through the things that turn the relays on and off, don't go through the ADD converter part.
So we may actually be able to run the program the FPGA to 2.5 and set the IOs to LVDS and it will work fine with a 1.8 volt bus.
I don't know. When you run them at 245 megabits per second, margin is not very great.
The thing is,
but with LVDI, it's differential and it has common mode rejection. So it should have a fairly wide compliance on the LVDS input.
Depends on where the center voltage is, because that'll change with the by setting it to 1.8 or 2.5.
Right.
It'll move it. So, and that's probably the biggest thing it'll do to move it. I suspect that the peak-to-peak value won't change much between 1.8 and 2.5. It's just it'll be moved down in the spectrum. So the common mode hopefully will take care of it. We don't know.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I've got a TI-based system in Altera FPGA that I can look at. So yeah, they did it.
Yeah, do they have a 1.8 volt A to D?
I don't remember what voltage interface it is.
So Scotty, you're saying that the FPGA doesn't have 1.8 volt differential inputs?
It has 1.8 volt differential inputs, but it doesn't do the LVDS standard at 1.8 volts. It requires, and we can strap the VCC IO of the FPGA to 1.8, 2.5, or 3.3. That's adjustable. However, all of the IOs of that bank go to that voltage. So, so if you need a mix, then you're stuck. However, since all the inputs are 3 volt tolerant on the FPGA, 3.3 volt tolerant, so since they're all outputs of the A to D, strapping the FPGA for 2.5 is not going to break anything. I mean, it might not work, but it's not going to burn anything out because they're all inputs. So,
I don't know. We're running a real high speed double data rate bus, and you know, if we run it into a weird voltage, hard to know what's going to happen.
But LVDS,
the ADC is on the RF card, right?
Yes.
And it's being interfaced directly to the FPGA on the data engine.
Yeah, it's got a pair of 14 bit outputs plus overrange.
Right.
And those are multiplexed onto a common set of pins.
Yeah, I know how that works.
Anyway,
there are no buffers in between.
No, they go straight from the part to the connector.
I trust the schematics are on the GitHub.
They're not there yet because they're not completed.
Oh.
It will be.
Well, if you could send me the part numbers so I can look at the sheets.
Yeah,
Scotty, I can take a look at that.
Can you send David the schematics?
Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, send me what you have.
Well, Scotty, if you could also send me the I2C interface for the magnetometer and temperature sensors. I want to incorporate that in my schematic as well.
Okay, from the data engine?
I'm
not sure what you're asking for.
I don't think you need the data engine.
No, I want to talk to the remote unit.
Because the magnetometer schematic's already up on the Tangerine page.
Oh, it is, okay.
So you can get that. If you want to see how we did it on the magnetometer itself.
No, actually I'm at the other end of it that talks to what's going out there, so.
Well, so on that board, the Raspberry Pi talks to it.
Right.
And on the data engine, all I have is a couple of pins from a couple of open collector program pins from the 1.5 volt bank of the FPGA. So I just basically a pull ups to 3.3 and outputs connected to the FPGA, and they just get programmed as output open collector.
Okay.
I mean, you can look at it. I'll be happy to send you the schematic and you can look at it.
That'll probably be helpful. That way we wouldn't have to digging around.
And then you'll have the pinout of the connector that I made. So
that would be helpful too. That's kind of important.
Okay.
Also to Nathaniel, I got Christina a Pi 4B with a heat sink that will work at the South Pole.
Oh, nice. That sounds good.
So she's all happy.
Wonderful.
You just need a heat sink if you're at the South Pole? Can't you just open the door?
Yeah, so what is special about this one, John?
Well, it's all aluminum, and without the fans on it, I got a 20C rise in ambient. With I put the fans on, it drops to about a 7 degrees C rise. But since you have to really rely on radiational cooling down the South Pole, since the air is so cold and thin, I took the fans off. So a 20C rise from ambient there is going to be no problem.
Right.
Because even here, it only takes it up to 40C. Down there, it'll probably take it up to 10C.
Right.
So we've it's solved your problem.
We've got a vault you can put it in that's at minus 40.
Murder.
John, just FYI, just to test it out, I've ordered a Raspberry Pi for a case that it bonds thermally to. It's shaped in such a way that it can bond thermally to the processor chip, but you can also plug into the pins. It allows you clearance to get to the pins.
That's exactly what I gave to Christine today.
Okay, so we'll have two of them.
Yep.
So, Nathaniel, do you have perhaps anyone available to discuss the space weather aspects of this project at Ham Expo this weekend?
This coming weekend?
Yes. And I'm not sure the exact times, but they're supposed to be like, it's kind of like a booth where the posters will be available and people can come and go and they can ask questions. And while I can answer questions on the Tangerine, I'm not sure that I'm qualified to answer a lot of HAMSCI questions on the space weather. I may be in a little over my head there.
Can you let me know what time?
Yeah, I can do
find
that.
Out the times. Steve, yeah.
Probably we can. Yeah, I don't need a like a Phil Erickson type, but you need somebody maybe a little more versed than I am.
Okay. I'm wondering if I might be able to step in and do some of that.
Okay.
Yeah, because that is a pretty high level thing. So I just
supposed to be 20,000 visitors.
Yeah, it so, probably would be a good thing for me to try to be there. Is that Saturday or Sunday?
It's Saturday, I believe.
Okay.
Let me, yeah, I can, while the discussion is going on, I can.
Yeah. So I just sent you back some comments on the slides.
Oh, okay.
I liked it a lot. My main comment was a few of the slides that you had on there, they came from ideas that we had early on in the project that never really took off. So they're perhaps more aspirational than they are.
Because I did steal them from the early slide decks, so.
Yeah, so some of the things like lightning detectors and rheometers, I think the hardware is potentially capable of, but we don't really have anyone actively developing those applications. So well,
Jonathan maybe for the lightning detector, right? But
well, Jonathan, I mean, maybe, but Jonathan's real interest is more in VLF. So you might, instead of putting down lightning detector, you might ask Jonathan very nicely to send you a slide on VLF science instead.
Well, this I put together about a half hour after the deadline. So it was like, I was just going to blow it off because I said, I just don't have time to make this up.
Yeah. But
my arm was twisted severely with the amount of people who are going to show up to say, you really need to do this. So, okay. So I put this together as best I could, but yeah. So
that, is it changeable or is it,
not changeable now for this event because the event's in like 5 days.
Oh, okay. Days. Well, but, I guess so.
But I want to change it for future events. And like for the HAMSCI workshop, this would be a starting point for where I would put something together. But probably I won't be doing this. I'll be doing the Tangerine. Well,
I guess what we can say if people ask about those things is we can say these are things that the hardware is capable of. And, you know, we're looking for community interest to help develop those particular applications.
Okay.
And for the other things, you know, things like the ionosonde receiver, you know, we're not actually an active transmitting ionosonde, but we are an ionosonde receiver. You know, we are actively developing that. And I put a few other notes in my.
But I think there's a lot of people who will see HAMSCI for the first time at this conference. So
yeah.
I hope this doesn't mislead them too much to think that we might be doing all of these things, but
yeah,
but kind well, of, a, of, hey, what are we going to look at? And these are the things we could look at. So maybe that's the way to phrase it. Like you, I think that's what you said.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to put it. And certainly some of those things, yeah, some of those things are active areas of interest for people associated with HamSci. And so they could potentially get done. So,
yeah, I noticed that the, like the real meter, the rheometer, whatever you call it, that site in Sweden, I think that's gone. That webpage is gone. So okay. I took the link off because it didn't work. So,
yeah,
but there was a URL on the slide.
Okay.
So maybe if we're going to do anything with that, this needs refreshing, I guess, is what the bottom line is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think maybe now is a good time to transition into what Jonathan was asking about earlier.
Well, before I want to talk about that, for lightning detection, that is well within my scope because VLFRX Tools has utilities for worldwide lightning detection. You just need more than three receivers to get accurate calculations.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, could you explain what VLFRX Tools is? I'm not familiar with that, but you seem to be very wedded to it.
So VLFRX Tools is a open source tool set for processing VLF signals. Normally these you would connect your VLF receivers to your computer sound card on a computer running Linux or FreeBSD or something like that. And it has a bunch of utility programs to capture the audio from the sound card. Let's see what else here. It captures audio from the sound card. GPS time stamping, filtering, whistler detection, chorus detection, detection of sudden ionospheric disturbances. There's a bunch of tools used for lightning detection, a bunch of different utility programs for a general signal analysis. It was written by a fellow in England by his name is Paul Nicholson, it's the definitive tool set for processing of VLF signals. He has a wonderful documentation page, and it goes in depth of what it's capable of. And I think using VLFRX tools is of interest to the HamSci community for VLF processing.
How well do you think that'll integrate with the Tangerine?
Well, since these are utility programs, they can be used to, they have a basic, ring buffer input and output. They could read from files.
But can it take data from arbitrary systems, or do you have to be using something that looks like a sound card?
Well, normally, let's see. Paul does have a utility to read from, an RTL dongle, for most of the VLF signal processing, it's done through a sound card. And the reason for that is that Paul believes that a sound card is an ideal VLF data acquisition system. That's why that he wanted to use it.
Well, is that a generic sound card or a high-speed sound card?
It can be any, depending on depending on the, you know, what you're looking for, if you're looking for higher sampling rates and better quality, or if you just want something to capture whispers and chorus, you could use a run-of-the-mill sound card.
Right, but that, if you use run-of-the-mill, you're limited to just whistlers and chorus. A lot of our other work is much higher sample or carrier frequency.
Right, yeah, that's why you could use higher-end sound cards. Paul uses that Behringer 404. Other members of the VLF group that I'm in use the Behringer 202 that has the Cirrus Logic DAC in it. You could use anything you want depending on your application.
Yeah, well, especially if he's got it set up so that he can take data from the RTL-SDR, we should be able to get it so that if we create a good front end, it can take data from the Tangerine SDR. We're just feeding it data.
One thing that was occurring to me while Jonathan was speaking up, I've got the, the Tangerine SDR puts out IQ samples, but it's very straightforward to feed that through GNU radio and convert it over to anything you want, and outputting it through an audio sync, for example, and spitting it out to something else like VLFRX tools. That'd be a fun project, actually.
Yeah.
To, see if we could interface that.
In fact, just as a general thing, being able to get it into standard formats like WAV file, any of our data would be useful.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I can do that. In fact, what might be even more fun would be to make an out-of-tree module for GNU radio that has a VLFRX tools embedded in it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's a project for, is Tom
a graduate student?
Yeah. An exercise for the student.
Yeah, it should be possible.
For reference, I posted the link to VLFRX tools. On his website, he also has live streams of VLF receivers. So I was thinking, or how I originally had thought of this was, I would output a stream that I could feed directly into VLFRX tools. There's a utility program called VTCAT, and that takes data from a network socket or another ring buffer, and allows you to move it anywhere you want. So the goal was to take the network stream, the socket coming from the Tangerine, and feed it into VTCAT, and then from there through a ring buffer, you could feed it through VT filter to filter out the mains and any interference, and then from there it could go anywhere within his tool set, and you have the ability to dump this data to files, extract WAV files, convert WAV files back into VT files when he uses. It's a very versatile tool set, and you could pretty much do anything with it. That's why that I feel that it's best for this use.
Well, you know, yeah. I don't know if it's open source where you can go in and make mods to it, but one thing that occurs to me is one thing we might consider is writing another module to add to the package so that it can take the IQ data stream directly without having to go through all the trouble of converting it to WAV file and then reading it into something else. So just something to consider.
Yep.
I think that's a good approach. I guess the question is like, what what exactly is the purpose of putting it through VLF-RX tools? And if it's, you know, specialized processing for VLF signals, that's very customized, and also for allowing it to easily be exported to the existing VLF community. I think that's all very good. But I do think it does make sense to take a look at taking it as an open source package and integrating it into the overall Tangerine software architecture.
Yeah.
So still be and using that code, but be in an integrated sense.
Yeah, and I think one of the things you were proposing, Jonathan, was possibility of having a standalone VLF system separate from Tangerine. And I think that's not a good idea. I think we want something that's all integrated in a common data stream. Otherwise, it's not going to get installed, not to the same density, shall we say, of Tangerine SDRs.
Well, right. Because, what I was thinking with that was to develop the a Leaf module board and make that compatible with the Raspberry Pi as a sound card. That's going to require some more work. And the other alternative is to work on a design that's a separate sound card for the Raspberry Pi. But that was something on the back burner once this board is all hashed out.
You could conceivably have take this card and then come up with a separate kind of like, you know, the reduced space weather station, have a basically a sound card interface portion that you plug the A to D card into, and then you don't need the full Tangerine SDR to use that card, but it's still makes use of the Tangerine development.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, because even the magnetometer is kind of a similar situation. You can right. run the magnetometer just with a Raspberry Pi, and you don't need the whole Tangerine. However, it can be, because it's a modular design, it can be folded into the full Tangerine personal space weather station ecosystem. Because
You can run the code on the Raspberry Pi and just plug the magnetometer on and not have a data engine at all. But you still have all the software.
Right.
I got to run, guys, so catch you all later.
Okay.
I wanted to mention we move too far along here that we missed Greg on the roll call.
Oh, Greg, do you have anything to say?
Oh, just that I'm looking forward to the workshop. And I guess you could miss me, but don't miss Nathaniel and Scotty.
Well, we don't. I was hoping you'd pipe up when I asked. Did I miss
anybody? I didn't want to rock the boat. I'm new, so.
Oh.
I only want to be missed if you have a firearm.
Well, I think the trick is with these Zoom calls, the roster moves around as people are speaking.
That's the problem.
So the poor person who has to do roll calls has to like keep track of everyone they've talked to and then keep hunting through the list for new people as it's moving under your feet, and it's not easy to do.
Well, if we're between things, do we want to try and touch on the questions that Dave had regarding the interface before Dave has to leave?
Well, yes, I had a couple questions. I've spent, you know, it's been 5 or 6 years since I worked a lot on OpenHPSDR. And I went back and reread Protocol 1 manuals and Protocol 2 manuals. And Protocol 1 is about 30 pages, and Protocol 2 is about 84 pages. And I realized it's full of stuff that we don't need. We aren't going to use. It's not really relevant.
Hey, Dan, I took that 84-page document, and I was going to convert it for our use.
Yeah.
Out that I could rip out about 80 pages of it.
Yep. So what I'm doing right now is I'm building a simulator so I have a simulator for the OpenHPSDR stuff, but I'm building a simulator to act like a Tangerine data engine. And we'll do a discovery and the kinds of things that I think need to be in the packet that comes back. And I'm trying to blend this as well as I can with all the documents that Bill has already written. So, and only change if there's something unworkable with the system, but I don't see that as being a problem. But one of the things, Tom and Scotty both brought this up, that there's stuff we need to know from the hardware that's the old system doesn't use. And the other thing is we're using a ping where we just took the next number out of the OpenHPSDR stuff. But if you read protocol 2, they reserve that number for other use unless we ask for it.
That's not the way we do it.
Yeah. And so what I would suggest is we just pick a different ping value and not worry about it.
What do you mean by ping now? I mean, I know it, but how are we using it here?
We were using an EFFE 07.
Oh, okay.
So 7, 8, and 9 in the other protocol were listed as reserved. So that means the OpenHPSDR guys want to have some say in what those are used for. So,
but Dave, once we get past the discovery, we're not really going to be following protocol.
No. So we could use any ping we wanted. And right now what I'm using is EFFE 0A, which is 10.
Is there a problem with using the same one they use? They're going to respond differently than we are, right?
Well, we'd have to sort, if somebody had OpenHPSDR radios on the same subnet, it would have to filter out which ones are which.
Well, Dave, the code that I wrote already does that.
Yeah. But what I'm doing that, but then I want to have multiple status values. So instead of just idle or running, I would like to have not programmed, but idle, running, those, something like that. We do need to have a list of the physical hardware that's attached. And I see that as RF1 and RF2. And there's, if I understand right, we have three options on each of the RF boards. And I'm hoping Tom will straighten me out on this. RxRx, RxTx, and TxTx.
Yeah, in fact, Scotty had multiple, more options than that.
Okay. Well, I was going to start with that, and then we can add options.
You also need to know which kind of clock module is plugged in.
So I had RF1, RF2, and then I had three values of clock modules, right?
Yeah, please call them 0 and 1 and not 1 and 2.
Oh, 0 and 1 for the RF board sockets. Okay. And then leaf.
Yes.
Some sort of reply from the leaf module.
Yeah.
And that would only be one leaf module at a time, right?
Correct.
And then you need something that pings the I2C or at least somehow you figure out what signals you can send to the I2C.
Yeah, so once you know how it's equipped, you should know which modules, you know, the modules will have a number, and and some modules will have two I2Cs, some may have none, some will have an I2C and an SPI. You'll have to have a table of equipage so that you can know what registers you can manipulate based upon what module's been plugged in to that slot.
Right.
Bill wrote the protocol for how to write and read those.
Right.
And I don't know if that's in the document yet, but Bill had a protocol that looked like it would do the job there.
Well, I mean, I've been going through his protocol, but I'm trying to fill in the details so that I can actually write the code. Okay. And I've been reading his code, but a lot of his code is what he needed to fix to do what he's doing. And what I'm trying to do is do what I have to do to talk to the FPGA.
Right. So I think there's a couple of extensions to the discovery response that could be used to convey status of the data engine to the host, right?
Like hardware configuration responses, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's
so the first one would be the hardware And then once we put some values in, what I assume is that there's going to be like a multi-tiered process. So you aren't going to, the way we have all these pieces, there isn't going to be like an open HPSDR, just a standard piece of code that you plop into the FPGA, right?
Right, there'll be custom loads depending on the science that you're trying to do.
Right.
But the idea is every one of those loads will have the, here is the configuration response built in. So
yes.
No matter what's loaded, you can still get the configuration.
But still, you have to have a ping back that tells the computer software what they're talking to.
Right. So that's, you know,
which is a software discovery as well.
Right. So, you know, we talked about adding a field to the discovery response for, you know, communicating the value of port A, because
yes.
In Scotty's proposal, you know, you have to know what port A is before you can talk to port A.
Right.
So you have to convey that back in the discovery response. You need some additional fields in the discovery response that say what all hardware was plugged into that thing anyway. And then I suggested some kind of a null terminated string after that, so you could figure out what kind of an FPGA load was on the data engine. So
right.
You have some clue as to what you're doing there. There's enough room in that discovery response to put all those fields.
Oh, yes. So
not only FPGA load, but revision too, right?
Yeah, but
yes.
You have a name. You know, in HPSDR, there was just a load that had a revision. But in HAMSci, you'll have a load that's used, you know, as a communication receiver. You might have a separate FPGA load for ionospheric sounding filtering. You might have a different load for some other science thing. So there could be three or four different kinds of loads, each of which would have a revision as well. So
yes.
I think we need to add that kind of information.
And that's what I'm trying to do, is actually write the specific hex line that will go one way or the other way.
And I think Bill's point was to also try to make things ASCII, make things human readable. We don't need to encode everything in hex that we don't have to.
Okay.
Is that a valid statement, Bill?
The idea. I mean, I don't know how important it is, but the idea that I had was that you could test this thing with a terminal.
Well, yes, I understand that. What I'm trying to do is based on what I know from OpenHPSDR, I'm trying to write how do you talk to the FPGA. So
you're talking about hardware specific commands and
response. Yes. Now in the FPGA, can you write an ASCII reply?
Yeah.
Or you said you were going to have a NIOS processor, right?
Right, with a UART.
Okay.
So, or well, it won't be a UART, but it'll be a serial data going to the UDP stream. Actually, it'll be an ACT UDP stream, right?
So
commands.
Yeah. So I'll have to read some more about that.
So, well, I mean, the ACK is our particular construct, whatever we build it to. It's not.
Right. That's what I'm trying. So what I'm doing is I'm trying to write code that talks to something that isn't there yet.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to figure out how to write a simulator that acts the way we want it to act so that it makes it easier to write the FPGA code.
Because yeah, I'll be simulating.
You know, it's a chicken and egg problem.
Yeah.
Which one do you build first?
Here's another question to put in the back of your mind. We have a red and green bicolor LED aside next to each RF slot, RFM0 and RFM1. Now, the FPGA could figure out whether it's smart enough to know what RF module is plugged in there and know that the load will work with that board.
Right.
And light the red or green LED. Or we can merely let the software query the hardware and then turn the red or green LED on depending on whether it figures out that it's compatible or
right.
not.
So I'm kind of in the latter section that I've been developing something that gets some basic query and then does a follow-up configuration query. So there's a basic query that's just what's physically plugged into the board set, because that's variable.
Okay.
And then once you have that, then you got to figure out, well, what kind of software is already there? And the bare minimum would be a bootloader. And there could already be an existing image.
Well, I would suggest that you don't have to ask about the bootloader, because if you can ping it, you've got a bootloader.
Right.
So
the bootloader is this hardware component, and that's what I'm working on right now.
Okay.
New country.
What was that?
That was just my computer saying
so. Okay. and I'm trying to stick to Bill's protocol as close as I can, but what I'm thinking about is something that comes in like his first line of his protocol. And I'm using the one that's off the website. Is that what you're, or off your GitHub?
Right, yeah.
And Bill, that's the one we worked out at Hamcation, right?
Right.
Yes.
And I also have been reading through line by line Bill's C code. So I'm paying attention to that.
So you know how he wanted it to work, and then you know how it really.
And so what I'm really trying to do is just make it so that I think before we get very far, we got to have a very clear description of what each thing does, how it talks to each other. That'll make the whole world work a lot better.
This is where I got really stuck on HPSDR, because how do you describe all of the hardware? And you can say, okay, we can say how many ADDs do we have? What rates can we run them at? But then when you start saying, well, how many virtual receivers do I have? How many virtual receivers can I assign to each ADC? Then it gets really nasty really fast.
So essentially, there is this problem that you have a finite amount of space that you can put stuff in. And you'll have to write the code that could populate that space. But you also have to say, okay, once I've used up some of the space for something, that reduces the amount of total space available.
But basically all you want to know is how many resources do I have?
Yes.
Because if we plug in on the Data Engine Mark II next year, we put a CVA-9 part that's 300,000 LEs, and we could do 80 virtual receivers at
a time.
We don't want to be limited by the protocol. We just want to make bigger tables.
Yes. Right? And that's what I'm trying to do. So anyway, I'm going through that, and I don't know. I'm assuming Bill and I should communicate about this. I've tried to communicate with Tom, and he keeps telling me to talk to Bill. So, and I haven't bothered you because you usually don't reply to my messages.
But I do like being kept in the loop, because if I see something that jumps out at me, I will reply.
Okay. But I don't see that we can get to even putting any code on the FPGA without getting this settled somewhere. Now it can change, but we need at least a shot at how it should work.
Yeah.
So Dave, is it possible to propose what you want to see in the discovery response in terms of the fields there?
Yes.
And ask Bill and Scotty and I and others to see if we agree with that.
Okay.
And then after we think we have enough, kind of the more static kind of information that comes back in that response, to see if we need additional things that reply with the more dynamic aspects of the configuration.
Right.
Could we do it in that two steps?
Yes.
So could you propose what you want to see?
And then ask the comments? I have roughly a piece of paper that has a bunch of that on it.
Okay.
So it's just making sure that it's complete and writing it out in a nice, neat way that you can read.
So Dave, and what I'm hearing that Tom is saying is that we want to make it like hierarchical, perhaps?
Yes.
So that you say, well, hardware is there, and then you say
hardware.
And then you say, okay, now what's the configuration of this module?
Right.
Because now I know there's one of them there. So now I can ask about that one.
Yes.
Is that what Tom said? I'm hearing that sounds good.
Yes.
To make it a hierarchy.
It's a hierarchy thing, and eventually we'll get to the point where there's something running there and Bill's protocol can talk to it.
Yeah, so now on the static configuration, once you know what's out there, what's plugged into it, and importantly, the name of the FPGA load and revision number that's out there, you now know how to talk to the FPGA to ask it questions about how many channels do you have? Are they chirped or are they linear?
Right.
Those kind of questions, which could change from FPGA version to version.
Right.
The discovery response format should be version invariant.
Right.
And then what happens if you ask for something that you can't get an answer to, you get a knack back?
Well, if
I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
In the virtual.
The invariant response would tell you what's plugged in out there, and you ought to know you can't ask that load of code that question.
So you can't ask the receiver what kind of DAC rate it has?
Not until the appropriate FPGA load's been put on the data engine.
Right.
But even that's so, you might ask something that's inappropriate, like the transmit rate of a receiver module. I mean, something that's not, that there's no answer to.
Okay? Right. But
you asked the wrong question.
Right. But that is what I call the variant part of the response. The invariant part of the response is something that everybody has to always do the same way. And part of that is the name of the FPGA load plus right. the version. Then once you know that, you know how to ask the next level deeper of questions.
Right.
Because yeah. you know what load's out there.
And that's what I've been working on is this very first step. It's like you've got an FPGA. We've used Quartus to put a bootloader in there. And now what?
And then, and probably what's going to happen is on the FPGA loads, since we're anticipating many of them, eventually you're going to get to the point where the FPGA loads are going to be have modules. So
right.
since you'll have an FPGA load that will always have a bootloader, and then it yes. might have a receiver module, it might have a transfer yes. module, it might have a VLF module. And if it doesn't have a VLF module and you plug in a VLF board, then
it just won't give you any response in that right. particular query.
Right.
Now,
this all sounds so much like SNMP.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, 1.1.1.1.2.
Yes. So I've been going around with this and trying to figure out kind of how to describe that. And so I'm at a point where I'm just about there. So within this next week, I'll have that description of the very first level, okay. the hardware level.
Yeah, yeah. So what's coming back in the discovery response, we can right. sort of agree on. And right. then after that, then we
can and I will have working code of that too. Okay. So I have a simulator responding the way it should and a programmer that discovers that software.
Okay, so very good.
Well, the algorithm and I'll code it in the FPGA and then it'll all work, right?
Right.
I like it.
But I don't know it'll be that easy.
Okay.
But, you know, if I had never done this before, it'd be quite different. Then at least I have some idea how to go about this.
We know it's going to be hard, but if it doesn't sound easy, then it'll be impossible.
Yeah.
Okay.
Something like that.
Dottie, I'm going to have to go here in a minute, but I'd like to propose something else additionally. I'd like you, David, and I, to have an email discussion about the ADC IO to the data engine.
Okay.
Because I think there's a couple of more issues that might arise.
Yeah.
I think the three of us can go work that out independently.
Okay. Well, I'll send you guys the schematic and then we can start with that. And then okay. we could look at the IO document for the FPGA and the A to D. And then those are really the two pieces that we need to talk about.
Right.
Right. So I think the three of us can work that out maybe by next week or the week after.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds good.
So that's what I had.
That all sounds good.
So I think if we get to that point, we could either use the IQ2 or the development board that you and I have.
Right.
To actually test out real FPGA code to see how it talks to your software.
That's why I'm trying to build the simulator so that then once we put something in that development board, it should respond to the same software.
Yeah, and the code is the code. So when we move yes. it to our board, it's the same FPGA.
Yes.
Well, same family. It's
family.
Size, yes. It's a smaller pinned one, but it'll act the same.
That's my hope.
Yeah. Yeah, it will. It's just we have to change all the pinouts to agree. Well, actually something that will be different is the Ethernet MAC
Well, Ethernet Mac will probably be the same, but the PHY is different, okay. Which is going to be a pain in the neck because, you know, I mean, you really want to program it for the PHY that we have. Yeah. And I don't have a development board that has any of that hardware on it until we get the actual data engine.
Now, I have it. I maintain the Mac in the string, the hardware string, the discovery string.
Okay. Well, that's part of the header, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The standard discovery response has the target Mac sent back.
Yes.
But I was talking about the actual Mac hardware that implements that function.
Okay.
It's going to be an IP that we're going to put in the FPGA, but it has to talk to the particular PHY that we pick. And there's tons of different PHYs.
Are we going to do the thing like the other where it just comes up and then if you want to, you can program in a hard address?
An IP address, you mean you could change?
Yeah, in the hardware.
Yeah, I think we need that feature.
Okay.
That's part of the same as we have in HPSDR. Right?
Right. So we have an example of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, right now on HPSDR, of course, the target gets its IP address from DHCP.
P, right.
Well, there's another problem.
The IP address is not plugged in normally. It normally acquires it by a lease.
Yes. But then if you want, you can put a fixed address in.
Okay.
In OpenHPSDR. Some people do it, some don't.
You know, another problem just occurred to me we're going to have that they didn't have with HPSDR since it was basically one unit per bus, per IP node. All the MAC addresses were the same. They were hard-coded to the same string, which we did not do. So what I'll propose is we have the chip now on the board that has a unique number, serial number.
Right.
I would just take that and hash that and make the MAC address out of it. And because I don't have a block of MAC addresses that I can assign, we'd have to buy those, I think, is the way it works. I know for USB, you have to buy a block if you want
address. It used to be that you bought a organizationally unique identifier from IEEE, which is the first three octets of the MAC address, and then the last three. They changed that recently, so you didn't have to buy a whole block, and there were sub-blocks, so I don't know. That's all changed since I last bought a block of those.
Well, at Zephyr, we actually build and sell a Wi-Fi module that has to have a MAC address. And we bought a block of 16 million addresses. Right. And I'm wondering if we could use, because we only used a very few of them.
Yeah, so. I was going to say, if you have a OUI that you already own, what you should do is continue to use that and then take some parameter from the board that you can hash into, you know, a probably unique second set of three characters.
Yeah, because trying to, even if we had a block, which I think we do, to get those numbers assigned to individual pieces of hardware is not trivial.
Right,
but into each board separately and uniquely.
Yeah, but you can, you know, if there's anything that you can get out of the board, like reading the double EEPROM and just doing some kind of hash function to try and come up with three, the odds of a collision on the same local area network are, you know, very, 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 very close to zero.
Well, we have we have two things, actually. One, each FPGA has a unique ID number programmed, hard-coded into it.
Okay.
So I forget how many bits it is. It's maybe 64 bits. It's some big long number.
Yeah.
Also, we have the encryption ROM that has a guaranteed unique 72-bit number.
Yes.
So we could just hash that down to whatever the remaining bits are in our OUI, right?
Yeah. You hash that down to 24 least significant bits, and then use your existing OUI as the most significant 24.
So we could do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll have a email
extravaganza.
Yeah, whatever it takes to get this fixed.
Yeah. So, it's time. We've delayed the documentation as long as we can.
Yes, want to get it on paper. You know, specifically what these things are doing, and I want to use Bill's stuff that he has as much as possible. But this is before it's like stuff we need for the hardware part before Bill's protocol thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully the invariant part will be really close to what Bill's already got.
Yes. And I'm thinking that's good.
Only change it if you have to.
Right. So,
Sounds good.
It's nice to, but between Bill and I, we'll have working simulators for these things.
So on that note, let me, if I can share my screen, I'll show you what we got for the data engine. Can you see it?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
So this is the placement for the data engine. So you can see the clock module, we moved it over to the left side because it works better for the layout. So over here on the left, if you can see my cursor.
Yep.
Yeah. And we have room to grow it to the right some. This could be moved out of the way, this header. I think that's the programming header for the FPGA or the jumper selectors. Anyway, so we can move that out of the way and we extend this over the top of whatever's underneath here. And the idea is that the clock module will have no components on the backside except for power bypasses. So no, and it's, I don't know how many layers it's going to be yet. The data engine is projected to be 10 layers, which is the stack up here. And this is just a preliminary guess to the stack up because we don't know which planes are going to have the control impedance calculation, control impedance lines on them and which ones don't. So this is a general starting point. This is very preliminary. The leaf is the blue outline board here that extends down to the two connector here and the Raspberry Pi header up here. So the red outline is a Raspberry Pi board, is a hat board, and the blue outline is a leaf board. That makes sense to you. Power connector in upper left, stacked Ethernet connectors here, one over the, it's too high, 2 gigabit Ethernet ports. A USB 2 port here vertically, it's upright. And then the USB 3 port is down below the clock module underneath because it's only a millimeter high, or 2 millimeters high. And the FPGA being here in the center, and this is the DRAM right above it. And then over here is the micro SD card, which is small enough to fit underneath where the RF or the leaf module goes.
So, Scotty, I have a question.
Uh-huh.
If the RF boards are lapping under the other side, is there either a hole or a standoff or something to keep it from flopping on the other end?
Yes. And that is actually these two holes right here.
Okay.
And then these two are for the other RF module.
Okay.
So they've got the connector on one end to support it and then the two holes.
Okay, very good.
And then for the leaf module, you've got the four holes here.
Right.
In the corners. The clock module, you have the one hole here.
One hole.
Two connector down here. This may move around depending on what the layout is, but there'll be one hole basically. And then this is the battery for the real-time clock over here. This is the optional buzzer, which I don't even know why it's there, but it's not going to be on the original. It'll be a place for it, but it won't be there. I put it on there because it was on the Lime SDR. And I don't know what they use it for, but hey, what the heck, you know? And then this is a fan header right here for using internal fans. So what we've done is we moved all the I/O over to the left side.
Yes.
So the top and the left are the I/O, and the right-hand side will be internal I/O, or like the SD card, there may be a slot there for you to plug it in, but there's not going to be, it's just a slot. There's no connector there. It's flat on the board. And then the bottom is just the RF module. And I have this is the RF modules mated to the data engine. You can see the blue is this is the top view, I believe. And the two RF boards are in blue. And interestingly enough, the RF boards are 115 millimeters tall and the data engine is 100 tall. So you can see how this pads out here along the bottom, this is the connector on the RF module. And it actually solders down here, but the connector outline is this blue outline that comes way up here like this, so that these fingers plug into it.
Oh, okay.
So the connector is deep. It's like more than 10 millimeters deep, or like 15 millimeters. But as you see, the black outline here is the board, is the data engine right here. It ends right here. And the RF module sticks down to here on the bottom and is even at the top. And these slots here, these are for end launch SMAs for the RF coming into the RF modules. And these blue things, these are the protection diodes for the relays that are mounted on top of the RF module. And you can see this is a problem right here, because this is the Ethernet module, the dual Ethernet module, and it's got through-hole pins. And the RF modules are only about 2 millimeters off of the data engine. And that's not enough for the height of the diode and these through holes of the connector. And I really don't want to make a requirement for the manufacturer to have to trim off these pins. So, and besides, when you're plugging the boards together, you don't want pins to catch on components. It's a bad thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, we may have to move this diode up just a little bit or over so it's in between these rows, or over so it's in between these rows, because these are all surface mount parts here. So at any rate, that this is the thing that the 3D modeling helps us do, is avoid things like this that are going to catch on each other.
And then, Scotty, where does the antenna connect to the clock module?
Off the side. So if we go back here, that's the rat's nest. But if we go back here, the clock module is down here. So we'll have SMAs coming off of this side, which is actually better than we had them originally coming off the short side, but there's actually three connectors. So might likely have one down here and two up here, or maybe move this down a little bit and put all three of them up here. It's going to be really tight. We also have a fourth one that's a vertical one. That's this guy right here. That's the optional clock input. If you want to feed a reference clock into the clock module and use that for your reference instead of the GPS.
Oh, okay.
And then we got a GPS antenna, and we have a PPS out and a clock out, I think, are the three SMAs that come off the side. Again, this is preliminary. Things are going to juggle around a little bit, but the main thing is, if you look at this, this is the rat's nest. This is what has to be connected. So you can see why.
No problem.
Yeah, everything away from these connectors here, because he wants this general area in the middle here to be available for routing, because it's, even at 10 layers, it's going to be challenging to do it.
I'll have my son Anthony work on that. He likes rearranging wires.
Okay. Probably better at it than we are.
He certainly knows what he wants to do.
Yeah, he'll graduate from university by the time he finishes.
Yes. Yeah. Think about doing that with multicolored pencils.
Oh. Yeah. So one of the
things I used to do that.
I took this to the Scorpions meeting, and then the guy says, "Well, can you really route wires over the top of each other like that?" No, we can't. So, but the idea is too that they're color coded so that the purple wires can be pin swapped amongst themselves, but not amongst the cyan wires, not amongst the yellow wires. These are bank coded. So. Purple ones generally, although you have to do pairs, so you have to swap a differential pair. The N and the P are dedicated. So if you pick the N, you get the P automatically because they're together. But you can take those two pairs and swap them with each other, and to eliminate as many of the overlaps in routing as you can. And the guy that we have is an expert at this. We did a different board for another customer that had an FPGA on it. And we got the thing looking so good, there were hardly any crossovers. And we did that one. That was only a 256-pin BGA. And we did that, I think, in only 6 layers. He did it. I didn't do anything except say, yeah, you can swap those. And then, of course, I have to go back to the schematic and swap them, which is a pain in the neck. But it's well worth it, because otherwise it may just not be possible within the number of layers. You could fix it by adding more layers, which then costs you every time you build the board. Or you can put a little NRE in to straighten it out. So here it is, a trade-off. How much do we want to pay him versus how much do we want to reduce the cost of the board, or not increase the cost of the board? But he's been doing this for as long as I've been doing engineering. So he's extremely good at this, and he can tell pretty much when he says it's going to take 10 layers, it's going to take 10 layers. And you can try to push him to 8, and he will just bitch constantly until you give up and give him his 10 layers back. And then he'll do it in the 10 layers. So he's good enough to know that this is what it's really going to take, so you're going to need this.
Well, it's just a curiosity thing. Is there ever any issue with crosstalk between wires, that crossover between layers, crosstalk between the wires and the different layers?
Yeah, and typically you try to route adjacent layers perpendicular to each other to minimize that crosstalk. And if you have differential pairs, like almost all of these are to the connectors, you route them very close together. and very close to the ground plane, and you put a ground plane layer in between so that you get the return currents are, well, the return currents are typically in the wires, but if any single end signals, you want the return current to follow underneath the wire as it goes out across into the board. And one of the tricks is if you have split ground planes, you never let signals cross the split in the ground plane. So what you do is you put the sandwich, a split ground plane in between, like say power and ground layers that are solid. Because if you run a wire from across the ground plane, the return current has to come back somewhere. And if it has to flow through that ground plane that's not part of its circuit, it's going to find a way to do it, and it's going to mess you up. So you want to try to avoid that as much as possible. And so it's like a big juggling act. I mean, you got all these pins down here that can be swapped. Then they have to go to the places they have to go. They can't be swapped over here. And you want to keep them away from the pins that are technically interfering with them. I mean, they're in the same group. You got to separate them by layer. And then you want to separate them by orientation to make them perpendicular. And it's a skill, I think, to be able to do this. And some people have it and some people don't. And I've worked with CAD guys who really I didn't think were that good because they couldn't visualize how it looked in their head. I mean, I think that if you're going to be a mechanical guy, you got to be able to take whatever you're building and 3D rotate it in your mind's eye and be able to see it. Otherwise, you're just not going to be able to do the job very well. And so a lot of this, just placing the parts on here, he's grouping the parts so that the groups of wires go kind of like in a bundle. And he doesn't put that one down here and that one up there so they cross over. And he's trying to keep areas separated as much as he can. So like there's a bunch of blue wires that go up here that go, this is the PHY for the Ethernet. And I'm not even sure what a lot of these are. This would be the USB 3 controller. This is probably the USB 2 controller because it goes to this connector right here. And then this is the DRAM that we're going to have. These are the power supplies up in here. And I told them I don't like power supplies underneath the leaf board, but there's not really a lot that I can do. Although when if Jonathan builds his VLF board, switching power supplies are not the thing you want next to your VLF board inputs, because they're likely to fall right in the input frequency range you're going to listen to. So what we're going to do is we're going to take these and we're going to cram them as far to the south as we can get them, so that when you plug the leaf board in, the analog part will be up here, but the digital part will be down here. Once you get it digitized, it won't interfere anymore. So that's about the best we can do. And again, it's all about trade-offs and doing the best you can. And then if we screw up, then we have to do another rev because we have to.
I presume they can't be put on the bottom side.
They can't be put on the bottom side because I don't want anything, especially switches, on the bottom side facing the RF modules.
Right, that's true too.
Yeah, yep. So, and we have a solid plane, almost a solid plane on the back of the data engine. Like I told them, R's and C's can go back there, but I don't want any components back there. And on the RF modules, no components on their back. They go back to back. No components on their backside. So basically you have two copper planes facing each other. So with a gap in between. So ideally we're going to get the best isolation that we can between the boards. And we made provision also, we're going to make provision on these power supplies to put a shielding can over them. So that if we have to, we could put a can over them and to assist us in mitigating any RFI that we have from the switchers. But again, these switchers now, these are Empyrean switchers. These have built-in shielded inductors, and they're extremely low RF noise switchers. So,
what switching rate?
I think they're 300K.
Okay.
No, they must be higher than that because the inductors are so small. I'm not sure what they are.
Yeah.
They're 3447s, EN3447s, if you want to look them up.
Let me look. 3437
and 3447. And they cost a little bit more, but by the time you add up the cost of the inductor and a flywheel diode, you're paying the same amount anyway. And these are so nice because if you see this right here, this group of maybe 7 or 8 caps, these 3 caps here and that part, that's the whole power supply. Everything is right in this little group. And he hasn't done anything to minimize this yet. So he's going to lay these out around the power supply. And then he'll have a block that'll be pre-routed that you can just move it around. Same for these other supplies up here. There's 4 of them.
I'm not finding that number. What's the number again?
So second here. It's a 33-37, I think. One second. It's really kind of stressful working on three different boards at the same time, because like a CAD guy wrote to me, he says, there's a problem with the decal name of J11. And I look on J11 and it's like the power connector he recommended that I use. So, I mean, I know he's got the right decal. Well, he was talking about the clock module, not the data engine. So it was a different part number. So one second here, I will go to the data engine right here. And where am I? Okay, you have to close the program before you can reopen it again.
Oh, excuse me, gentlemen. I'm running down. I'm going to go QRT.
Yeah.
Okay.
If anybody needs to get in touch with me, you should have my phone number. But that means you, Dave. If you
really so you're going to be included on this email that Tom and Dave and and I are going to be hashing.
Okay. Good.
Is that a good? Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay.
73
Bill.
I need to go as well, so I'm going to go.
Okay. It's an EN6337. Sorry.
EN?
Echo November 6337.
I'm sorry. I spoke at the same time you did.
EN6337. Here, I'll put it up in the chat.
There we go.
Type.
Oh, okay. So an Intel thingy.
Yeah, it's not Intel anymore because they sold off Imperium. So I don't know what they call it anymore, but I designed this.
Comes up under Intel.
Yeah, it's still listed that way, I'm sure, because they sold it off in the past 6 months. And I designed these in before Intel sold off the division. So I'm using them anyway.
Okay, let's bring up that data sheet.
And the beauty of this one is for the VCCIO, I basically used a separate regulator for each RF module. And then we have a jumper that programs it to either 1.8, 2.5, or 3.3 for that module. And that drives the VCCIO for that bank of FPGA that runs that module and also supplies power to that particular VCCIO pin. So, in fact, I can show that.
Switching frequency free running 1.9 megahertz.
Yep.
Right in the middle of the 160 meter band.
60 band.
But we can sync it externally anywhere from 1.5 to 2.3.
Means we can move it out of the band.
Yeah.
If we use this, I grounded the sync pin, but it's in auto LLM mode. And that allows it to go between, okay, now I'm going to have to remember the two.
Yeah, I see its efficiency is good in that mode.
Yeah. But you see the jumper here, you can pick which voltage output you want. And then this goes to run the VCCIO bank and the VCCIO pin on the RF module.
Uh-huh.
So that way I don't have to actually jumper any high current traces. I can jumper the reference, and then these are all hardwired.
Right.
Yeah, when you think about it, there's over 200 0.1 microfarad capacitors on this board. 217, I think, to be exact. And, you know, I try to put to make the layout such that it will work. And so, you know, I'll take kind of like my ORCAD program. I'm just drawing lines, right? And I'll build a box that's 100 by 100, and it's just scaled, right? And then I take the big parts and I build a scale box for them, and I place them on the board to see if everything will fit, right? The trouble is that with 200 capacitors, you better leave a lot of space in here, because there's a lot of things that go in there that you didn't show on your diagram. So yeah, I can get all the parts on the board, but there's no room for routing, there's no room for capacitors, there's no room for any of that stuff. It's like, for instance, on the back of the RAM, all these capacitors along here are going to go on the back right at the power pin to the ground plane,
right?
I think we were talking about using 0201s there because of the fine pitch, and he's figured out a way, if you build the layout of the BGA, if you take the capacitor and you take the normal footprint and you cut the corners off of it, so the capacitor still fits, still centers itself, but the pads are a little bit smaller because the square corners are cut off. You can actually diagonally fit a capacitor between two pins and the ground pin and the... So you can get the capacitor right dead on the pin that needs to be bypassed. and it works great because
that's tricky.
It's very tricky. So then I went through on the design and I changed all the capacitors for the FPGA to 0201. He says, no, 0402s fit in between those pins because they're further apart. So I don't know what we're going to do this time. He's got this figured out, the bypassing. He's done at least a half a dozen designs with this kind of RAM and FPGA before. So I have pretty
good confidence
in that. So and like I said, just tonight, we got a read-in of the clock module. That means all the parts that were on it, tentatively on it, are read in. So he can see if they're going to fit in the outline that we have. And the problem is, on this, what you're seeing here is this is data engine parts. This outline of the module is actually, I'm on the wrong screen, right? The outline of the module here, these parts are not on the module. This is an X-ray view.
That's underneath it.
Board. Right. So the problem is that the GPS module is like a third of the space. So the question really is, are we going to get both GPS modules on there? It'll be one or the other, but you have to have footprints for both. And unfortunately, one of them has a whole array of ground pads underneath it.
Oh, dear.
Otherwise, there's small, one small enough, you could put it inside the other. And you can put either one, but you can't do that with all those ground pads there. So,
Random idea is that could we make a little daughter card for that one?
It's possible. We could stack them.
Yeah. So that we kind of hit but the ground pads.
My preference would be to just extend the board out and put one here and one here, and then put all the rest of the good stuff down here.
Right.
Because then you start running into connector costs and assembly problems. And I know we've done, have you ever heard of an interposer module? So what happened is we had a guy come to us. This is an amazing story. We are Altera design partners. We've been with them for 20 years, right? When they first came out with the brand new, I think it was the Stratix 1 probably, the new FPGA, and it was some big 1152 pin BGA or something. They put the wrong footprint up on the web page, and it was only there for a couple hours. Some customer loaded it and made a board using the wrong footprint.
Oof.
And of course, when they got their boards back and then figured out that it didn't work, they were really pissed off. So they, went to Altera and said, "Hey, you screwed us over. You cost us all this money." So Altera comes to us and they say, "Well, could you make us a PC board that's the size of the footprint of the FPGA with 1152 on the top and 1152 on the bottom, but they're all cross-connected. Pins are cross-connected." And we had to have blind and buried vias because we had to have a pin coming off of a ball on the top one that had to go over to the side, but you can't put a via all the way through because you got to have another routing layer. It was 28 layers, this thing.
Wow.
It was 100, regular boards 062. This was bigger than an 093 board in thickness and had 28 layers. But the problem is it cost like $10,000 for each unit because they're only building 10 of them. So they have to amortize all of the tooling, all of the engineering, all of the building of that little 28 layer module. And you have to put balls on the bottom and then you have to solder on a BGA on the top. Oh, well, now you better use different temperature solder or one operation is going to interfere with the other operation. So they had to use like some exotic temperature solder on the top to keep the BGA from falling off when they soldered it on the assembly on the board. And every step of the way, it was more money, more money, more money. But Altera paid for all of it because the customer was mad and Altera screwed up. And so
assembled the boards before they found that out?
I assembled one of them at least.
Yeah, because at that point I'd have just respun the board.
Well, that's what we suggested. But they apparently had built all of the they had fabbed all the boards, and it was some big giant assembly that would cost to redo. And
ouch. But
most of the interposers we quoted after that, the customer ends up not doing because of the cost. Seems like a good idea, but it just is prohibitively expensive.
Yeah, well, I've hand-wired adapters like that. BGA, though, but for quad flatpack.
We had this rework girl at Motorola that was a genius. She took a 225 PGA. Remember the what pin grid arrays?
Mm-hmm.
It had actual pins on the bottom, an array of pins, and you plug it into a machine socket. And what she did is the guy who laid the board out, the engineer, gave, let's see, he got the bottom view instead of the top view. So the thing was mirrored.
Yep.
All the pins were mirrored. So she actually took a socket and rewired two sockets to cross the pins over from one side to the other.
Yep.
So you, these two sockets, the female one up here, she plugged your part into, the male pin sticking down, and she wired from the male pins down to the male pins, and it was just like this sandwich of wires.
Yep.
And she got it to work. And, you know, the way I would do it is after the third wire, the fourth wire would break one of the first three, and then I go back to fix that, and it would break another one, and it would never work. But it looked like a wire wrap board in between, you know, with just this mass of wires.
Right, right.
But she made the thing work. The patience of Job to get that to wire that.
Yeah, I haven't done an adapter that big, but yes.
Yeah, that was the worst one I ever saw.
No, but we did a lot of 56,000 designs. Those were pinned.
Flat packs are nasty too because they're narrow pitch.
Yep. Oh, very. Yeah, 0.5 pitch and wiring,
ooh,
soldering wires to it. Because we did, what happened to us is we spun a board that the pinout was different for different footprints.
Oh, no.
And it got mixed up, footprint and pinout. And we had to get it prototyped. So a couple of these we hand wired while we respun the board.
Well, it's like on the magnetometer. That's a 50 mil part. And mm-hmm. I had to swap two pins, like pins 2 and 3.
Right.
I gave up. I mean, I'm pretty good at rework. And it was just, I got one to work, two to work. Actually, I have to have two to test it, right? I got two to work. And then I said, okay, that's it. I took it into our CM and I said, here, I'm going to pay you to do this because... And it comes back just beautifully done and tacked down, and just it's not worth hacking it up yourself. Let the pros do it. So anyway, that's where we're at. Just thought it would be interesting to. This is the most interesting one with all the wires on it. It's just unbelievable. But he comes back and he says, "Well, I'm not worried about that at all." Okay,
yeah, that's a pretty straightforward routing job right there.
Yeah. So
that's very. So he did this placement. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, we did it. I mean, we worked together. And he's the one, though, that came up with moving the clock module over to this side. Because I had the clock module on the right. And
right.
And the lead.
Yeah, I can see that was all going to be crossing over all that other stuff.
But then that's why I hire him, because he can see the stuff.
No, he's got a good eye.
Yeah.
I can tell.
So, yeah, we first worked on a project together in 1985, I think, 86.
Mm-hmm.
So he's almost ready for retirement now.
Ever tape a board?
Pardon me?
Ever tape a board?
I have, but he came in after the tape.
Yeah, well, I'm just asking. I mean, I date back to the tape and colored pencils days.
Tape and X-Acto knife, right? On vellum, on transparency.
Yep. Yep.
I built a double-sided 1K RAM board. Used 2102s, remember 2102s, 1K by 1 RAM. So I had an array of 8 of them, and I actually managed to align the front and the back sides with 2 holes, and then the vias were just wires stuck in, soldered on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, it's a miracle I made the thing work, but I mean, I'm thinking 1K by 8, 1K byte memory. I mean, really? 1K byte?
1K bit memory.
No, it was 8 chips. So
1K by, oh, okay, by yeah, yeah. So put together, but the 2102 was a 1K bit.
Right, right. So I used 8 of them, so I had 8K bits, 1K byte, and it was, I was happy that I had this big memory. But of course, that was in what, like
76?
Exactly,
yeah. My first computer had a 2K memory.
When 2708s, 1K by 16 proms were $100.
Yep.
And I remember a guy, he built a controller board for something for one of the computers in the lab. And he got the layers reversed. So not reversed in order, but he got them flipped. So he ended up having to, I still can't believe this worked. He took it was all dips, right? he took the dips and he took the leads and he bent them back around this way and put them on the wrong side of the board. And then the pins lined up and he could solder them in.
Oh, you can do that once.
Oh, my God. This is the guy that had a bunch of 2708s on his board. And he had some kind of 200-volt, the 5 volts had some kind of 200-volt DC offset on it. So he was scoping the board, right? But so the way he got around it was he put the scopes on an isolation transformer.
Right.
So that their ground pin of the scope could float to whatever you needed to. Well, some guy comes in while he's not there, needs the isolation transformer, takes it, plugs the scope into the wall.
Oh, no.
All the 2708, you know, with the little windows. He said all the windows turned black. He put like 200 volts on the 5-volt line and just destroyed everything.
Well, the smoke didn't get out.
Oh, I think there must have been smoke. I mean, I don't know how it. But did you, he said, the one guy told me too that if you take a 2708 and you turn it upside down or 180 and plug it in upside down, that the bond wire glows for a short time.
Until it
becomes an incandescent lamp.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to know how he knows that.
Probably about the same way that you know that an electric lit a capacitor blows up if you plug it in the line.
You plug it in backwards, you mean?
No, if you take a polarized electrolytic and plug it into the wall, it explodes.
And why would you do that? For the explosion, right?
For the explosion.
Of course. Why would you drink Diet Coke and eat Mentos? I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, 50-50, right? You lose. Okay.
Well.
Okay. I guess that's all I have. So it's getting pretty late here.
Yes, it is.
Same here.
Yeah, you guys on the east. Well, it'll be better. No, it'll be worse next time, won't it?
It doesn't really make it.
It'll be the same next time.
It'll be the same. It'll be easier for me because it'll be an hour
early. You're the only sane place.
The same place
clockwise. I heard the EU just abolished daylight savings. Did anyone hear that?
I didn't hear that.
I'm gonna have to look at that. I think it's an ugly rumor. But
by the way, Nathaniel, the QSO Today Ham Expo actually runs Friday and Saturday, and the talks are all on Saturday.
Okay.
So they probably won't have a lot of booth activity on Saturday. It'll be mostly on Friday. I don't know what that does for you. Makes it worse or better.
What time on Friday?
I don't know. I've got to find out what, because if it's open most of the day, I don't know. I've never done this before, so I don't know what the active time will be.
What we can do is we can, you know, if we know what the times are, maybe we can come up with a controlled list of people who can come and help person the booth. And like
1 hour shifts and get like 6 or 8 people. And
yeah, something like that. So, I mean, maybe I could do a little bit of time. I'm sure I could commit Dev to do a little bit of time.
I could do some time however useless I'll be for scientific stuff.
Hey, Nathaniel.
Yes, Greg.
I can send you the list. I'm helping Eric in some of the back office stuff. So,
okay.
That'd be great. I can send you the times.
Yeah, if you send me the times, I guess, and how to how we participate, maybe we can get a couple people who would be willing to help out.
We got hosts and co-hosts for all the presenters, and I've got all the times. I'll fire them off to you.
It's for the space symposium. It's a space forum. That's the one that invited us to come.
Okay.
The people from ORI that are doing it.
Yeah. So I mean, maybe Hyoman can help out for a little bit. Maybe Jonathan Wood or David McGaw. As I said, I can try to do a little bit of it.
And I think, Greg, is it true that I mean, we might not have it all covered, but we would have, is there going to be a schedule for when like booths are manned as well as the talks?
Yeah, I'll fire it off what Eric sent to me.
Yeah.
Okay,
I can copy you as well, Scotty.
If we have know exactly like what times and how to connect, then I can distribute it to an appropriate list of people who could help support it. You know, Bill Lyles, he's into this sort of thing, and he would be very good. Steve Serwin would be a good person to have involved in this. We have a number of volunteers that.
So I've been talking to Michelle about it. She's the one that invited us. So I'll see if she wants to have multiple slots covered or what exactly is she looking for. I've never done this before, I don't know whether she wants the whole day covered or if she's settled for just like an hour on each side of lunch or something. You know, that'd be good.
Yeah, hopefully if you need like multiple hours covered, or even if not, I think if we could split up, you know, we have a number of volunteers who know space weather things that would be good to spread the work out a little bit.
Okay, well, I'll get with her and see what she's expecting and then get back with you. And then I guess because she's telling me she has to make a schedule up, but I mean, that's for speakers. I thought I didn't really think there was a schedule for booth duty, but that will be public. I mean, maybe it's just scheduled for her to make sure everything's covered.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as I said, let me know and we can try to find people who could probably help out.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. It's such short notice. And I really wish I'd gotten that chart out earlier to you for the suggestions.
That's okay. Everything's such short notice because we're all doing so much.
Like I said, I was just going to blow it off.
And then, yeah.
No. There's 20,000 people going to show up. You need to do this.
Twist,
you know. And so I said, okay, I guess it's important because you want to get the word out. There's going to be a lot of people, I think, we'll be seeing this for the first time.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Hey, Scotty.
Yeah.
Is your email address on QRZ? I don't have yours.
You can. It can be scotty@talks.com or wa2dfi@arrl. I'll put it up here on the chat.
I got Nathaniel's.
Thank you.
I can spell it right. That's it there.
Yeah, Eric was scrambling for assistance. So I'm doing about five different time slots as hosting in the back office stuff. So he's looking for guys.
So you're like a moderator?
Yeah, we have a host and a co-host because if we get lots of questions, one guy can't handle it. So.
Yeah, so you want a couple guys on each talk?
Right. So I'm doing about five slots, but when I checked this morning, there was still a whole bunch of empty slots.
So is there just one thread of talks then on Saturday? And the talks are all on Saturday, right?
Yeah, I think there might be a couple on Friday night, but the bulk are on Saturday.
Okay, because I was looking on the website, and it looked like, at least for the amateur space radio, they have all their talks are on Saturday, and then they have a couple events in the evening, which we're not going to be associated with, and then they have the Friday booth open.
You're talking about this Saturday, this weekend?
This weekend, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like they've got multiple tracks.
It runs on Sunday as well. So.
Oh, it does. Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to fire it all those times to you.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
It'll be awesome. Another seminar. And then we got HamSci the week after.
Pretty busy.
Busy. And still trying to get boards out at the same time.
We had to make a decision with the HamSci workshop with the QSO Today Expo, because we were offered basically, do we want to be a part of the QSO Today Expo? And it was a very, very nice offer. But one of the things we wanted to do is we wanted to maintain our own identity as our own workshop. So we didn't really want to get assumed into something larger.
It would be kind of like if DCC merged with HamSci.
Yeah, but it'd be it'd be more like if DCC merged with Hamvention, I think.
Yeah, get sucked up because they're big and we're little.
Right. Yeah. I think it'd be more like that. So and we just wanted to, since we're like kind of we're an NSF sponsored project, and you know, we just wanted to maintain our own identity as our own thing. So we also wanted to make sure we weren't competing against Ham Expo, because that would be bad too.
And did you see I put the NSF grants on the bottom of that poster?
I did. That looked wonderful. Thank you.
Hopefully it's not too small, but I want to get it all on one line.
Yeah, no, that's good. They don't ask for the numbers to be big. There's no, but it's always, the acknowledgement's always small at the end, but they want it there.
So I haven't read all the emails for HamSci yet. Did you say you had a poster, a place we can go to build posters?
For the HamSci workshop?
Yes.
Yes. Do you want to do one?
I want to do one for Tangerine.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, I need to know that right now.
Oh, okay.
Actually, if I'd known that about a minute ago, it would have been better because I just sent an email to the iPoster company saying, here's the updated list.
Oh.
But I think I can, they don't open, they're actually in Sweden. So.
Well, you want me to send it? Because
I'm No. I have to be the one to send it.
Well, then tell them you're in the mountain time zone.
That's I love it here. So here's what's going to happen. You want this, you're the one that's going to be making this poster, right?
Right. And this is using those tools that you demoed to us a couple months ago, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Scotty, so let me put you on this list right now and let's get you added to this whole thing.
Now, once we get the poster made, is it pretty much captive for Hams and I? We won't be able to take it out and use it anywhere else?
For 12 months is guaranteed to be available on their server.
But we just have to link to it then.
That's right. Okay. And in fact, and they tell us that for 12 months, it's guaranteed is guaranteed contractually to be available for 12 months. We are told that after those 12 months, it's still supposed to be on their servers forever, whatever that means. And as long as you have the direct link, if you don't know what the direct link is to it, then you kind of lose it. But as long as you know what the direct link is.
You'll be able to search for it, then it won't appear in the search.
Thing. Right. But if you know the direct link, you'll still be able to get to it.
We could put the direct link on the web page.
Yes. And that's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So the answer is you should be able to keep working on it. So what I need from you right now is I have to grab from you. You're going to be Scotty@tonks.com. It's going to go to there, right?
Right.
The thing I really miss about the in-person workshops versus the virtual ones are the happy hours.
Yeah. You get a lot of communication done during that time.
It's so much fun. I agree. It's
also the people that you see that you didn't know you needed to talk to, right?
I know.
Mm-hmm.
I know. All right, so okay, give me what do you want to call this poster?
I guess you could just call it Tangerine SDR Hardware.
Tangerine SDR Hardware.
Maybe I should call it Architecture. Tangerine SDR Architecture, that would be better.
Architecture, okay. And you want to present in English?
Oui.
Okay.
That's the extent of my French. So yes, it's going to be English.
All right.
Pig Latin.
That's it. So all my input's going to be in equations. So.
Okay. And then can you send me a one paragraph abstract for this thing?
I can.
Okay.
I can do it in the next 10 minutes. Right. So.
Yes. Well, you can do that.
I better do it in 10 minutes because otherwise I'll forget and then it'll be like 3 days. Exactly. It'll be too late.
Again, abstract and co-author list. And I'm going to send, and I have to figure out which breakout room.
Because basically what I'm going to do is I'm just going to take pictures from my 18 different slide decks that I've presented over the years and paste them into pictures like what that poster was.
That sounds very, very good.
Thank you.
I'm glad you told me about this. And incidentally, I actually really want to use this poster session thing because we're actually for a lot of reasons, but I went through a lot of trouble to get this contract set up for this thing. So I want to actually make sure we do good things with it.
If we get to use it for a year, it'll be a really good way to get to just like a short, concise description of the hardware out.
Yeah.
Are we able to edit it after the event?
Yes, I think up for a certain time, and I can certainly, I think since I'm kind of the account owner, I can tell them that I want you to be able to edit it for longer.
Okay. I don't know that I'll have to, but you know, especially as things go along, if it's going to be there a year, we'll have updates and things.
Yeah. I may actually, I mean, now that I think of it, I have a bunch of money I can spend on this. So, I mean, maybe I can extend the contract to like 2 years or 3 years or whatever, but because I have plenty of money to do that.
I'm presuming that after 1 year, no more editing, because it's just a static link and that's all you get.
Yeah, and then after a year, you'd want to make a new poster anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So let me...
Well, it's good to have plenty of money, that's for sure.
So yeah.
Amazing how much you save when you don't have to rent hotels and catering and...
That's the thing. I had a budget for an in-person workshop where you are flying everyone in and putting them all up in hotel rooms, and all of a sudden you are not doing that. So,
but the virtual happy hours are not the same.
The virtual happy hours are not the same.
They are not the same.
I was looking forward to Scranton, and then this whole schmazzle started.
I'm really hopeful that we can have it in Scranton in person next year.
I'm hopeful we can do DCC in September.
That would be so nice.
That's a little iffy, but you know, I was not looking forward to going all the way to the East Coast last year for 2020.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going like, oh yes, it's going to be virtual. And now this year I'm going like, gee, I hope it's not virtual. I hope we get to actually go there.
Well, we have some really, I really want people to like to see our campus, and I want people, and we have this really awesome hotel, this Radisson Lackawanna Hotel. It's an old Lackawanna line train station, like one of those grand old train stations that
That was where I was going to stay at until it got canceled, right?
Dang. Yeah.
Steve Bible is probably just as mad too, because he's a train nut.
I know. And then you have the Steamtown National Historic Site. I mean,
oh, is that where Steamtown went? Yeah. Oh, yes. I want to go. It used to be up here and I never got to it until they moved.
Yeah. What? So yes, we have it. I have to figure out, okay, Scotty, what breakout room?
Figure that in when we get there.
There's a friend of mine that was I knew in high school. He was a couple years ahead of me, so he was pretty much graduated by the time I was in high school. And he was a train, I mean, this is a definition of a train nut, okay? This guy, he built his own railroad. He called the Delaware, Susquehanna, and Northeastern, DS&NE Railroad, which is totally fictitious. He printed up timetables for all the schedules for all the towns that it went through. And then he went down to the local cop supply store and he bought a whole railroad policeman's uniform. I don't know how he finagled the badge out of him, but he got a fake badge and he would go down to the radio, to the rail lines, and he would just hang out and pretend like he was a railroad policeman. What was really cool was I had this terrible history teacher in ninth grade, and apparently he gave her a fake railroad pass for this Penn Central Railroad, and she tried to use it, and she got caught. And then I'm like, good for you. Miss Graham got arrested for using a fake railroad pass. Couldn't happen to a nicer teacher. And then you would disparage his railway, he would get very upset and say he had the best railroad in the state and blah, 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 blah. And I mean, he took it very seriously, so.
I have a high school classmate who, to this day, I think, has all the schedules memorized.
Wow.
Across the United States. Europe, too.
One of my ham friends from grad school, who's been to Hamvention a number of times, Kenny, he was a train nut. In fact, his call sign, I think, is K4NNW, which is North Northwestern or Norfolk Northwestern. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, he even got his call sign around. So, Scotty, the question for you. For these eye posters, I'm breaking them up into the breakout rooms, and I've been trying to split the breakout rooms so that there's no more than, say, 5 posters per breakout room, and that the posters are more or less grouped by similar topics. And
I'm just looking at this as who do I want to hang out with and who do I... I'd like to be in room 2, please.
Hang out
with David and Christina, but it doesn't really fit there. So,
well, it doesn't really fit anywhere because none of them are really hardware posters. So, two might be just as good as any of the others.
Have you put the title in already? Can you change it?
Sure.
Because I'm thinking maybe it would be Tangerine SDR. I mean, Tangerine SDR, Personal Space Weather, PSWS Hardware. Or something like that. I got to link it to Personal Space Weather Station somehow. Tangerine SDR 4 Personal Space Weather Station. How about that?
Tangerine SDR 4, the HamSci personal space weather station. How about that?
I like it.
Okay. So that's going to go to the poster company. Now, here's how I do this. So next thing I do is I'll put you in poster room, breakout room two, and then I can explain how I'm planning this breakout room thing to work out. This is going to be an experience.
Actually, did you have John in there somewhere in AUR?
Not as a poster. Does he want a poster?
Oh, no. I just thought I saw he's a presenter then, right?
Yes. He's a presenter.
He's right after me. Because I was going to say, if he's talking about the clock module, he has a poster on it, then it belongs with that one. But he doesn't have a poster, so.
No, you are the only hardware poster, it looks like.
Oh, boy.
I think.
That's like when I went to GNU Radio Conference.
Uh-huh.
When we were in Atlanta, I think, in 2000. I forget what year it was, 10 years ago, maybe. And I was, I think, one of the few hardware presenters that was there. And I mean, these are all young, genius software guys, okay, in this group. And you look out and their eyes are like glazing over because they really don't care much about hardware. They're all software guys.
Oh, man.
It was kind of, and I went from being one of the youngest guys in the room to being way, way, way the oldest guy in the room. When GNU Radio, all the old hams left and all the new young software guys showed up and I was the oldest guy.
I think I remember you telling me this story.
Yeah.
If there weren't hardware, their software would be pretty useless.
That's right.
This is true.
We had a feud between the hardware and software guys at Motorola when I was there, and the software guys snuck in and said, software makes hardware happen. They had their CAD guy design a poster that they put up on the wall, said software makes hardware happen. So we had our CAD guy make up a poster that says, without hardware, software is just a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And we put it up right next to theirs.
By the way, referring to our previous conversation, people who are into the railroads are called ferroequinologists.
Ferroequinologists. I like that.
They were called nuts.
Okay, so I have it linked now.
Uh-oh.
So you are now in iPoster breakout room 2.
Oh my god, so now I have to make something.
Okay, so here's how I envision this working. So starting at noon, we're going to switch over from the webinar format. This is on Saturday. Yeah, we'll switch over from the webinar and we're going to go to a Zoom meeting link. Okay. And the Zoom meeting link will support up to 1,000 people.
Okay.
And I can set up breakout rooms, which I think we played with a couple weeks ago, right?
So these breakout rooms appear simultaneously, right?
Yeah, I'll actually set up, I have 7 listed right now, but I'll probably set up like 20 or something. I can actually do that right now.
That means when I go into room 2, I'm not in any of the other rooms, and the 1,000 people would be distributed amongst all the rooms depending on what their interest is, right?
Right. So like right now, I just opened up 25 breakout rooms.
Oh my
god!
And
you can choose which one you want to go to. So at the beginning of the session, what I'll do is I'll explain to everyone how this works. I'll say, okay, these room, and then each presenter will have, 5 to 10 minutes to present what their poster is about.
Okay.
And then it's open discussion. And I'll assign a moderator to each room.
But now these, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So that means each person gets 5 minutes. That's 25 minutes plus Q&A. And then, but all of the people in this room are looking at all of these posters, right?
That's right.
So how do I, if I go to this breakout room, how do I pick which poster to look at, or am I fed the poster that the person's talking about?
Well, during the during their time that they're giving their talk, you're being fed the poster.
Okay.
But at the same time, it's not there yet, but I will have it so that when you click on one of these, there will be another link here that says URL, and you'll actually be able to go visit that particular poster.
Okay, but that will be just looking at it. That will be talking to the creator then.
Right. So, but this will give each creator, 5 to 10 minutes to talk to a group of people.
Okay, but us 5 creators are all in the bullpen together. And while I'm talking, they can't talk and vice versa, or they shouldn't talk.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay.
And then at the end, will you have like a Q&A for anyone then who wants to?
And then after that first, like, say, hour where people are going over their posters, then it's a free for all.
But they're still separate rooms, though, right?
They are, but you can jump between whatever room you want. So you can either hang out your poster in this breakout room, or you could go somewhere else.
And but go now, ask someone about their poster. Okay, I got it.
Right. Now, can you, when you're looking at, so if you look at the breakout room list right now, if you click the breakout rooms, are you able to see who's in each breakout room?
How do you know? I mean, I'm just looking at your screen.
Click on your control button on the bottom. Do you have a button that says breakout room?
Well, don't I have to point my browser there? I mean, I'm just looking at your screen.
No, on your Zoom.
Oh, so
if you stop looking at my browser, stop looking at my
screen. Oh, yeah, I have breakout rooms.
And do you see everyone's name in the list there?
If I click it, I see, oh, yeah, room 1 through 25, and Mike's in room 1.
Okay, so you can see that.
Yes.
All right.
Then
so
I
now
I'm over here to join any one of the rooms I want.
Right. So then, so basically after that first hour where people are presenting their posters in an organized fashion, then it's a free for all. So now people can play with this breakout room feature and you can go chase people down.
So if I were to say, go to room 5 and say join.
Yes.
Then what am I going to see? Am I going to see anything that signifies the 5 posters, or am I just going to see the 5 people?
You'll just see the people in the room.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
And then I take it, since I could see that Michael was in room 1, you'll be able to look down the list and see who's where and try to, this ought to be fun.
Right. And then you can.
Playing whack-a-mole.
Exactly. And then, like, let's say you want to have a side conversation with someone. You could, like, direct message them, or you could go track them down in their breakout room and be like, hey, can you meet me in breakout room, you know, 30 or whatever, or 25?
Channel
19.
And
then you can have a side conversation with that person in a separate breakout room.
We should rename these to channels 1 through 23, and then you could be like a CB.
Well, we could do that too. It doesn't let me. The problem with it'd be nice if it let me rename the rooms on the fly, but in order for me to rename the rooms, I have to close them down and then rename them and then open them up.
Oh.
So like,
so how do you open up 25 rooms? You have to enter 25 names first and then open them?
No, that's a piece of cake. I just click breakout room over here, and then I can choose here. I can actually make you.
But then you can't name them. You just get room 1 through N, right?
Here, you're now a co-host. Can you make your own breakout rooms now?
Let's see. Breakout rooms. Add a room. Yeah. But it just adds the next number. Okay, wait, can I change the name? Rename. Yeah.
And like when you first do it, when you first set up the breakout rooms, it asks how many rooms do you want to have? And you can do up to 50 of them.
So you can add 50, but then you got to go one at a time and rename them all. That's
So that's why I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Well, look at this. There's a button that says open all rooms.
Yeah. So, yeah, click that. Now people have the ability to go to the different rooms.
Oh, I see. So this is allowing them into the rooms I just created. Okay.
Yeah. And so this way, yeah, so at least if I create like 25 or 50 rooms or however many I want, you know, then it gives space where we have the first, you know, 1 through 7 rooms. That's going to be where we have the organized presentations for the first hour or so. And then after that first hour, it's a free for all. People can go have side conversations in different rooms.
So more like happy hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except not so happy.
You have to bring your own cocktails.
Yeah. So, you know, if you don't have a good time in happy hour, it's your own fault because you're supposed to bring your own stuff.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. But I really wanted to make this, the workshop, more interactive, even though it was online. And so I thought this would be a way to do it.
Yeah. Sounds like fun. It'll be interesting to see how it works.
Yeah. It's going to be an experiment. I don't know. I think it'll be good, but it could be a disaster.
Yeah. Well, I think it'll, even if it doesn't work out the way you think it will, it still will be fun because it'll be interesting because everybody gets to choose their own way to go.
Right.
So it's just like walking away from one group and talking to another group.
Exactly. Yeah. So it should be a really interesting way of interacting and talking.
So I can just see it. Uh-oh, there's Bob McGuire. Bye. Click. And then you're gone.
But now you can actually see where everyone goes.
Yeah, that's true. So you can't hide. You could change your name though to, you know, McDuff or something, and then nobody know who you were.
You could do that, yes.
you could do on the QT, and so nobody would. We remember, Dan, we used to have people like that on TeamSpeak who would, you know, they'd put like Mickey Mouse up, or they'd put some name that nobody knew just so they could listen without having us know who they were.
Yeah, that's true. But usually you could figure out over time that they were. Yeah, I remember that.
Sneaky people.
Yeah. So let's see. Okay. Well, that's good.
Cool.
I'm glad you're going to do a poster.
And let's see. So this is Friday and Saturday, right? No, nothing on Sunday, right?
Nothing on Sunday.
But it's good. Of course, it's going to start at 6 a.m. on Friday for me. 8 a.m.
Oh,
right?
Sorry.
Time. I know. It's funny. Somebody was bitching at me. Why are all these conferences all on Eastern time? It's people on the West Coast, right?
Uh-huh.
And I found one that was actually on Pacific time.
Uh-huh.
And so it's like, it just depends on where the organizers live. They pick their own time zone.
Which I've thought about that too, but now I have people participating from Germany and Norway. And
but now they want to be a particular time for them because...
Right. Our keynote speaker is in London.
Yeah, so afternoon's not so good for him. It's the middle of the evening.
Yeah, her. She'll be... She's at 5:30, you know, Eastern time, so it's going to be like... I don't know, 10, 11 o'clock at night for her.
Well, no, that's England's only like 5 hours from the East Coast.
Yeah, so if she's supposed to start talking at 5:30 here,
it'd be
10:30 at night for her.
Yeah. Well, one of our board members of Taproot is in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know, it's like plus 15 for us. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. You know, even at 8 in the morning, it's midnight for him.
Yeah.
Like that. It's late.
Yeah. So it is is quite the experience.
Well, you know, with global conferencing like this, you just figure out when you have to be awake and then you just have to be there and that's the way it is.
Yeah, I know. It's just kind of
too bad. I guess I don't know. I think it's being up in the middle of the night for one night is still better than jet lag. For flying somewhere and being there for like 4 days, and just about the time you get acclimated, then you turn around and go back home.
Yeah. Yes.
And you won't lose your luggage.
Luggage. Or if they do, then it's, you know, it's your own baggage handler's fault. So.
But you know, doing all this organizing, it's a lot of work for this. I don't know that it's. I'm not sure that's actually any. Easier than an in-person, I guess it is, but it's...
Well, it's different because you're just sitting at your computer most of the time instead of going and talking to people, right?
Yeah, which, like, my whole life now is pretty much sitting in front of a computer.
That's right.
So, which I love using computers, but...
Well, we're going to see, too, as I get my second COVID vaccine on Tuesday night.
Mm-hmm.
So, if what happens this time is like it happened last time... I'm going to be grumpy on Friday.
You're getting it when?
I'm getting it on Tuesday night.
Tuesday night. Okay.
11 o'clock at night.
Oh, boy. 11 at night. Why 11 at night?
Because they schedule. Well, that was an early one. They scheduled them 24 hours.
And
And actually, it turns out they said for the second shot, you can come in anytime within like 4 hours of your time.
Huh.
They don't care. But.
Okay.
I think it was actually at 10:45 or 10:48 was the scheduled time, but it's nice because there's no traffic. I mean, we drove right in and right up, and the longest wait we had was the wait that we have to wait afterwards to see that there's no side effects, that they make you wait in line. They write the time in a marker, in a dry erase marker on your windshield,
mm-hmm.
and you have to stay there until that time is up.
Wow.
So when they give you the shot, they write 15 minutes later on the windshield, and then you have to wait.
Huh.
And because I guess there's people that do have bad reactions.
Yeah.
We didn't have them, but
yeah.
Then they let us go. And really, other than that wait, there was no waiting. And it was, you would not believe it. It's a stadium. Okay. This is a football stadium. Okay. Mm-hmm. In one of the giant parking lots.
Mm-hmm.
And they put cones and tape, you know, do not cross tape. And they mm-hmm. make as a rat's or maze, and they have volunteers with flashlights at every corner So there's a guy there going that way, and then they take you and they split you into multiple lanes when you have to go in and fill out a form or talk to somebody. And then you come down to only a couple lanes, and then they spread you out into more lanes when there's a wait involved. So when we got to the place where we actually got the shot, they took us out of this tent, which was a couple lanes, and they spread us out into like eight lanes wide. And they had a guy there directing you over there, you over there, you over there. You were like shuffling cards, you know, like dealing cards.
Yeah.
So we were only in the line of maybe three people. And then they had about four post-shot spots to park. So that means that was only about 4 minutes per slot opening up. So it moved pretty fast.
Wow.
It was amazing. I think we could have gone at, you know, 2 in the afternoon when it was mobbed, and it would have been the same.
Yeah.
Because they were ready.
Wow. It really helps when they're organized.
Yeah. And really, it was like you could – I was in there. It was at night, so you couldn't see anything, right? You have to – you can't tell where to go with the cones everywhere. So yeah. I'm just driving straight until they point me to go a particular direction.
Yeah.
And there's no problem.
No.
So – And I talked to some of the people, and they are all volunteers.
Wow.
They're all volunteers. I mean, not the people actually doing the shot.
But the people doing the traffic control.
Right, but the traffic control was all volunteers, and all the people came in, the people to question you, like, do you have any allergies? Do you have any reactions to medication? To fill out their little forms. They had volunteers doing that. They had, like, iPads, and they would fill them out.
Wow.
And they want to know, is this your first one or your second one? Because some people sneak in for the second one, even though they're not supposed to be doing that at this place.
Yeah.
And then when you get up to the front, they give you the assignment for your second shot right there.
Yeah.
They give you the date, 3 weeks from the same date.
Yeah.
But they said the timing is much more lax for that one. Like I said, you can show up 4 hours early for it if you want.
Okay.
So I think we'll go a little earlier, but not a lot, because it's... traffic's much easier at 8 o'clock at night than it is at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
Because that stadium is like 40 miles from our house.
Okay. So it takes you a little bit of time to get there. It
takes some time to get there. It takes like 45 minutes to an hour, depending on the traffic.
Yeah. You guys are ahead of us. I'm an essential worker and I haven't had mine yet.
Really? And you're in Canada?
Yeah.
So are they giving it to... above 70 year olds yet? 75?
Well, my dad's 95. He gets his tomorrow.
Wow.
And
Who was it that John Gibbons said that they just opened it up for 50 where he is, and it's mayhem. I mean, it's like, you know, there's so many people that are eligible now.
Yeah. They finally in New Jersey, they just opened it up for teachers on Friday. So my sister was able to get her shot. Her first shot yesterday.
Well, aren't you able to get yours?
Nope.
Even though you're a teacher? I mean, a professor?
I'm in a different state. The rules in Pennsylvania are different from New Jersey.
Oh, right.
And I think, I'm not sure, sometimes to differentiate K-12 educators from college. I think would Pennsylvania...
Would it depend on whether you're required to go in and teach in person or not?
I don't know. But I think in Pennsylvania, I'm considered an educator. But I'm not sure. I think New Jersey, when I looked at the rules, I think it said K-12. So I'm not sure.
Oh. So, Greg, what do you do?
I work for a large electrical utility.
Okay. So are you considered an essential worker then or not?
Yeah. Well, electricity, basically, if you don't keep the lights on, all chaos breaks loose. So we're essential workers.
So then do you get the ability to get vaccinated earlier?
Well, as I just said a minute ago, we're not even scheduled yet, and I'm an essential worker.
Wow, so you're in like the first group then, and you're
I'm 60, just turned 60. I'll get a little bit of priority, but nothing like my dad. So
over 75 is ahead of essential
workers. That's right. Okay. Yeah,
because I know in here they had group 1A and 1B, and 1A was essential work was healthcare workers, not even schools or essential workers. They were just healthcare workers. And 1B was essential workers and anyone over 75. And then they decided that they weren't getting enough people coming in, so they lowered it to 65. And then they got a whole bunch of people come in, and now I think it's still sitting at 65 at 1B. They haven't opened it to group 2 yet, but...
Can I ask you questions about the Tapper merchandise?
Sure.
Okay.
I may not know the answer.
Are you familiar with this device?
Oh, for pure signal. Oh, that was an HPSDR thing. I'm vaguely familiar with that.
Okay.
I have one sitting right in front of me.
Oh, there's your expert right there.
Okay. So Phil Erickson pointed this out to me. Would this work if I need a TR switch to protect my receive stack from my transmitter? So I have an antenna switch, a manual antenna switch. I have my ICOM IC7410 100 watt class transceiver sitting on the desk, and below me I have my my Grape PSWS, my Red Pitaya, which is running as a whisper, an RBN receiver, my Edis USRP with advanced receiver, advanced research receiver, preamp running, and something else as well. That's all going through splitters. Would this be appropriate to put in line to, so that when I transmit, it protects the receive equipment?
Oh, come on. I'm on the page now looking for...
It almost looks like a scaled down Red Pitaya in a sense with all the ports.
I think the answer is yes, Phil.
I think the answer is yes, but I was trying to not say yes until I actually looked at it to see if it might actually work.
Phil Erickson told me it would. I just have not had time to actually read it. And
well, Phil must know, you know.
Yeah. No, I.
Does he have an HPSDR system? Or
this was a John Ackerman deal.
Yeah. So John would be the person to ask.
Yeah, if he would. Because the purpose of this is really to sample the transmit signal, isn't it, Dan?
Yes. Yeah, there's a little bit of leakage through the switch, and you can you can use it to do pure signal.
So that also, there's a little bit of leakage that comes out of the sampler?
Yes.
So that also means, could you then like attach the sampler to a scope or a spectrum analyzer?
Yes. Yeah, it's used for adaptive pre-distortion, or what is called pure signal. And it's basically a way of distorting the transmit waveform in such a way that it comes out as a better signal.
Yes, you read down here, it says it's important that the sample signal is at least 10 dB stronger than any leakage or crosstalk for the rest of the transmitter chain. Because, of course, you want to get the output, not any intermediate stages.
Yeah.
Because that's what, if you're using pure signal, that's what you're going to correct. That's what's going to determine your correction factor is the feedback.
The actual transmitter.
Yeah.
Okay, so then the receive stack gets connected to that. Okay, so that's the sampler.
It's a general purpose TR switch and requires only 12 volts and a standard ground on transmit keying signal, which I'm sure you said you had a 7610?
Yeah.
I'm sure that'll provide, the amp keying output will provide
which
that.
Which goes correct. Right there.
Yeah.
Yep. So this is basically all set to go.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a chassis case that you know of that would fit this nice and easily?
Not that I'm aware of. It comes as a kit. It doesn't come as standard.
But there's no enclosure.
There's no enclosure.
Yeah.
And the TAD enclosures are all way too big.
What's this?
You can ask John though. John might know of an off-the-shelf something that you could actually drill up to put this in that would fit it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't actually have any mounting holes on it. So
it doesn't.
Yeah, but you could, it does have enough room on the edges that you could slide it into a slot.
Well, it also has screw ferrules for the connectors.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
You could, if you've drilled the holes, you could slide those in and put nuts on them. And although I would put two nuts on the SMAs,
mm-hmm.
because you want it to be the bottom nut to give you a surface that's the same height as the two BNCs,
mm-hmm.
and then put another nut on the outside to clamp it to the panel.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because it looks like the SMAs are in a little bit further than the BNCs are.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
That looks like the TR switch circuitry stolen off of the filter boards, which is actually a good thing.
I think that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Does anybody know where the feedback signal goes in the transmitter chain?
It goes to the receiver. The receiver and the transmitter are running at the same time.
They're full duplex. So you use the receiver to listen to the transmitter to get the error signal to feed, to invert and feed back in with the transmitter to correct it.
Okay.
So you're using your receiver while you're transmitting as kind of a monitor. And hopefully the amp key output of your 7610 will key before it starts producing power.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's designed to do anyway.
Right, yeah, because it's supposed, right.
So like, yeah, like Mike says, no hot switching of the relays. It'll destroy them pretty fast. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you also don't want to switch the antenna while the RF's on, because that's aside from your receiver blowing up.
Presumably the output, that keying output of the 7410 would be sequenced appropriately.
Right, and you get like 50 milliseconds or something before RF comes out.
Yeah.
I've seen a bunch of VHF bricks that the antenna switching relays were all burned up. Well, they use RF sensing to key the relay. And by the time the relay's keyed, I mean, there's plenty of RF there to burn the contacts.
Yeah.